Hey, folks, today's episode brought to you by my favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeSebaDay.com. And you'll notice I am hiding the coupon code. Why?
Hi, ding. Nothing.
Our friends at... Why am I hiding it? Because our friends at Sunset Lake know it's not easy to be thankful these days. So they wanted to extend their thanks to this show, our amazing listeners, and a special shout out to Brian for all the lifted tea love.
Yeah, I've had about 47 of them. So it's pretty nice of him. I love tea.
Yeah. The holidays are coming up, which means less daylight, colder temperatures, and a little extra stress on top of an already nutty year. As we wind down 2025, you deserve rest and recharge. Thankfully, our friends at Sunset Lake have kicked off their Black Friday sale. Right now, you can save 30% site-wide when you head to SunsetLakeSebaDay.com, as you can see here, and use the code FRIDAY25. That's the word Friday. The number's 25, no spaces. They got everything you need to chill out, catch your breath this holiday season. Tinctures that help you sleep, gummies that help you sleep, or make it a what hilarious time.
I hate you guys.
And even smokables like keef and pre-rolls, flower. Honestly, folks, great company, great product. It'll be the highlight of your year. I can't read the copy because I get tears in my eyes. I honestly can't read.
What is going on? Do you want me to finish?
You get a bonus, I think, for 100 if you spend $125, but I can't tell what it is. No, it's the orange. It's the citrus flavored 750 milligram Seba tincture. I can't read the call to action because I can't see it. Head over to sunsetlakesebaday.com. Use the code Friday25, and you'll save 30%. So it's like 2025 Friday, but you'll save 30% on all of their wellness products for people and pets. They have tinctures for pets. This sale ends December 1st at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. See their site for full terms and conditions. Now time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, November 17th, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Murtaza Hussein, journalist covering the national security and foreign affairs at Drop Site News. On their series of Jeffrey Epstein's involvement with Israeli officials buying, selling weapons all across the world. Also on the program today, Trump reverses. Says House Republicans should vote to release Epstein files. Meanwhile, Trump floats Venezuela talks as the largest aircraft carrier in the world, a U.S. one, arrives off of Venezuela's coast. ICE invades Charlotte, North Carolina as results from Chicago show ICE is avoiding criminals and simply going after working immigrants and moms. SNAP resumes states gear up to boot many off of assistance because of the big, beautiful bill. Sparse data showing growing economic woes throughout the country. Taco Trump rolls back tariffs, exemptions on grocery food items. Meanwhile, USDA data inadvertently refutes Trump's promise of more Chinese soybean purchases. Trump floats a meeting with Mamdani as Hochul contemplates raising corporate taxes to help with Mamdani's agenda.
That's a reversal.
Trump administration to drop Biden-era plan to make airlines compensate for delayed flights, of course. And lastly, Schumer retirement rumor, followed by a renewed call for him to step down as leader now. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, and look
Monday.
Who is back.
I am back. I am back for my little jaunt out west.
Emma Vigeland back off of her Hollywood tour. impossible to turn on a computer or to look at a phone without seeing clips of you on multiple shows.
Yeah, I know. You seem agitated by this fact, but I'm promoting our show. You know, I'm promoting the show that we do.
I'm not agitated about it at all. I'm saying it's very impressive.
Oh, well, yes. It's like I decided I'll vacation a little with family, and then I'm going to do like pretty much work for Thursday and Friday at the very least. But I had a fun time out west. So,
wait, you just did shows on Thursday and Friday?
Yeah. Well, I tried to book Wednesday, and then I flew in
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
From San, yeah, right.
We got the rest of the days covered.
That was my vacation time with my family. Remember, I told you I was with my family.
Well, I thought that was going to be the weekend. It's not a big deal. Look, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you went to that learning, the comedy learning annex.
I brushed up on puns, and I'm going to quadruple down on that going forward because it clearly worked.
The left wanted to make comedy illegal.
Yeah. Well, it is
it's working
good,
so much.
Good to have you back on the East Coast. I enjoyed. I mean, I don't want to say I enjoyed the Office. What is the name of that
office
show?
Hours.
Office
yeah,
Hours.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a movie too?
Yeah.
No. Office Space.
Office Space. Oh, I don't know. It just sounds derivative to me. But I did see that. I did see that clip that you did with Tim. I always forget his name. Heidecker,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
he asked if you were as old as Noam Chomsky, and I said, no, not quite.
You know, that was the part I saw because I thought that was funny, and I was like, wait a second. Because I thought Tim was much younger than me, and he's not that much younger.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that his career has that feel of like just getting started.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like there's so much ahead of him that I thought that he was much younger.
Yeah.
A lot of people like even in their early 20s look like they're 50, mm-hmm. which is good for when they're 70 because
right.
then they look 50. I thought that's what Tim was going on with that Tim Heidecker guy, that it was like just getting started.
You know, I'd love to participate in this bit, but I have to keep all my options open at this point. But people, if they haven't, check out my Pod Save America thing. That seemed to, you know.
We linked to that yesterday.
Yes.
I think,
oh, you did?
Right? Didn't we? Didn't we link to it on Friday?
Yeah.
Yes.
Office Hours, Higher Learning. That was really fun. And then, of course, The Bituation Room with Francesca
Latham,
Fiorentini.
Right?
Yes. Well, Higher Learning and Rachel Lindsay, which I was very excited about as well, because she's the coolest bachelorette. But we don't need to get into that.
Well, she was like on that reality
show?
Yeah,
but she was like way too good for the show.
I never saw.
Way too good for
it. But I've seen Van Lathan.
We don't have to discuss
it. He's got very good stuff.
Yes.
All right. Let's. Matt's saying let's move on.
Okay.
Passive aggressive soundboard action.
Exactly. All right. We have no economic data, incidentally, that is coming out. And supposedly there's a rumor going around. I haven't seen too much about this, but supposedly the regime is talking about releasing the jobs numbers without releasing an unemployment rate, which would seem a little bit odd.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, Donald Trump ordered some grocery items exempted from tariffs, like coffee, like bananas, where we don't have these huge markets outside of maybe Hawaii to grow these. There were other items, I think, on this list. But I imagine in this environment, we also still have that concept of greedflation, and we may not see those come down for a while. If people can get away with charging more, they will. And the tariffs, the uncertainty with the tariffs certainly has created that environment. But inflation is real. People are feeling it. Here is Kevin Hassid going over the same Walmart claims that Trump made last week, I think it was, that Walmart's Thanksgiving dinner is cost 25% than it did last year, which is true.
25% less.
25% right? Less, yeah. Sorry, than it did last year. But it also has at least 25% less stuff in it.
And the fact that they have to be this specific about that meal in particular kind of says it all, right?
Yep. Here's Kevin Hassett, though, getting called on that little factoid.
The president claims that Thanksgiving costs are down 25%. I mean, does he know that's not true?
Well, if you look at Walmart and the few places that put out their prices,
Wait a minute. I got to stop because the Walmart comparison's like not a thing. I mean, Walmart had a Thanksgiving package last year. They've got a Thanksgiving package this year. The one this year contains much less than what the one last year took. So that's why the price is less. Look, we got a chart here. Last year, it was 21 total products. This year, it's 15. Total number of items in those products was 29%. Now it's 22. There's more generic brand stuff. So, I mean, Thanksgiving, if you're going to the store to buy groceries for Thanksgiving, it's going to be more expensive this year.
I really don't understand where you're going in the sense that Joe Biden gave us 20% inflation.
He's not president. Donald Trump's president.
And you want us to fix the hole that Joe Biden dug
right
away.
No, I'm just saying, why does the president tell
the prices went up so much under Joe Biden and inflation is way down. Inflation is about half what it was in December. This is something that's being fixed fast. And real incomes are up after dropping about 3,000 under Joe Biden. And so, sure, you could find a few things where the price is higher, but there's a whole bunch of stuff where the price is lower, like gasoline, like mortgage rates.
Get the Republican plan to
you understand deal. That mortgage rates have gone way down, and it's much cheaper to buy a home now than it was when
because
President
interest
Trump
rates
took
have
office.
Come down, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, wait, because interest rates are down because the economy is slowing down. That's why.
Can you imagine? I mean, obviously, the folks at ABC were very prepared for him to bring up the Walmart thing. It took about half a second before it was out of his mouth before that graphic was up there. But it literally is like, hey, come on over. Do you want to jump into my lawnmower and get chewed up? And he comes out. Now, one of the things about Hassett is he has the ability to smile even when he's obviously clearly upset.
I actually have a bit of a humiliation fetish. So.
Exactly.
This is perfect for me.
Yeah.
But yes, all of the markers that they're talking about in terms of going down, the interest rates is done because we're afraid of jobs, job loss. Gas is down because we're probably in a recession in parts of the country at this point, not to mention certainly in terms of manufacturing building. And here is Kevin Hassett sort of now trying to sort of make us understand why the jobs are starting to go soft. Now, we know they're going soft in part because you have 1.5 million people who have, in terms of immigration, who have either we have no immigrants coming in or immigrants afraid to go to work or immigrants being detained.
Yeah.
And that means like we only have 4 people on this job site. We need 10. And now we can't build this house. So everybody go home. Here's Kevin Hassett trying to explain. Well, we also have another problem, and it's just going to make things quiet for a while.
last CPI report we got surprised 48 Bloomberg economists on the downside, and even had some sort of temporary bad news because there was a refinery that was shut down, if you're looking at the top line number. I think that there have been mixed signals in the job market and really, really positive signals in the output markets. As you know, we've got GDP now running close to 4%. We've got productivity running up around 3%. And so I think that there could be a little bit of almost a quiet time in the labor market because firms are finding that AI is making their workers so productive that they don't necessarily have to hire the new kids out of college and so on. But because there's so much output growth and income growth, that's the kind of thing that, you know, a free market will work out relatively quickly as, you know, new ways to spend money emerge.
That's sociopathic. Basically, essentially admitting about that the job market for young people is horrific and saying that, oh, don't worry, the market will sort itself out with AI.
Just
that,
around the corner.
The apocalyptic outcome that we've all been warning about, he speaks about it in such a blasé manner.
Well, first off, there's no reason to believe that if what he's saying is true, that this is going to be a quiet time, that as if it's going to be just we're going through a rocky period. Why would that change? If that is the dynamic that's going on, why would that change? Why would we expect AI not to be able to provide more layoffs or more lack of hires? And when he talks about productivity going up, understand, again, and even GDP, if that's possible, although I don't know that we have really seen these numbers. But what is clear is if you don't have entry-level people coming into the business world, as it were, getting jobs, entry-level jobs, yet productivity is going up and GDP is going up. What that's basically telling you is that we are building this economy on fewer and fewer people yep. who are getting, because somebody's getting the benefit of that productivity going up, and it ain't those first-time workers. And so he says the market will take care of it, and it will find something else. We are seeing bubble after bubble after bubble in this economy, and I'm talking broadly over the past several decades. Right now, that bubble is AI. There is so much money that so few people have. They don't know what to do with it. It creates an anxiety for them that, like, wait a second, I've got $100 million in the bank. I've got $500 million in the bank. I got $1 billion in the bank. I need to make that money needs to be making more money for me.
Right.
Where am I going to do it? Somebody comes along and says, the next big thing is going to be AI. And they throw that money in there. And it is basically a Ponzi scheme.
Harvard economist Jason Furman recently said that AI investments accounted for nearly 92% of U.S. GDP growth in the first half of 2025.
So there you have it.
It's just entirely unsustainable. Yeah, go on.
Well, there's no profit being made from it.
Right.
Or I should say not substantial profit. And all it's doing is essentially increasing wealth inequality.
And also destroying our environment. Let's not leave that part out
jobs.
As well. Oh, that too. The trifecta.
All right. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Murtaza Hussein, who has with Ryan Grimm and others at Drop Site, been writing a series on Jeffrey Epstein's involvement in, I guess, arms sales. I'm trying to think of a blanket, like seemingly everything. But we will get to that in just a moment. Some words from our sponsors. We got a couple today. When one goes shopping, one wonders for the holidays, what can I get someone? What's going to have impact on them for the year to come? I have an answer. It is called Cozy Earth. It can be sheets. It can be pajamas, which are incredible.
Pajamas are
but also all sorts of other clothing. I am like, as I started to think about it, like so much of my any given day, I have Cozy Earth sheets. They are fantastic. They are temperature regulating. They are soft. I don't know what more you would want out of sheets. They're fantastic. They look great. But then I also have, I have Cozy Earth joggers. I have Cozy Earth, hoodie, which is my favorite hoodie. PJs. They're incredibly, you were bragging about your PJs the other day.
I love them.
And now they have something called the bubble cuddle blanket, which would be a great a gift along with some cozy earth pajamas. But also, I mean, they have incredible other gifts. The pajamas is what I'd go for. I mean, you give people sheets, I guess.
You can, yeah.
You have kids, maybe.
Yeah.
But honestly, you'll change their life for the entire, literally every night they go to sleep, they will be thinking about you because you gave them new sheets. But check it out. With the sheets, they got a 100-night sleep trial. If you don't love them, you return them hassle-free. They have a 10-year warranty because once you feel this level of comfort, you want it to last a decade. And I have had sheets that have worn out. Believe me, folks. Thanks to Cozy Earth for sponsoring this episode. Great products. Black Friday's come early, early at Cozy Earth. Right now, you can stack my code Majority Report on top of their site-wide sale. So in other words, you go there, they're having a sale, and then you get even more savings with the code Majority Report. That can give you up to 40% off in savings. That's CozyEarth.com. Code is Majority Report for a 40% off in saving. These deals will not last. So start your holiday shopping today. And if you get a post-purchase survey, be sure to mention you heard about Cozy Earth right here. Wrap the ones you love in luxury with Cozy Earth. We'll put the link in the podcast and YouTube subscription. Also, when we started doing this podcast, people were like, get merch, get merch. I was afraid to. And the reason why, because I didn't want to deal with a merch store. I'm like, it's going to be too complicated. I'm not going to be able to maintain it. I'm not going to be able to update it. I just don't want to deal with it. Years and years went by. People were like, why don't you have merch? Why don't you have merch? Finally, we did it with Shopify. And I will tell you right now, it made it so easy. You got to-do lists. You're worried that that the merch store is going to overcome it. Finding the right tool that not only helps you out, but simplifies everything can be a game changer for millions of businesses. And our merch store, that tool is Shopify. Hello. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from household names like Magic Spoon to brands just getting started. Shopify has hundreds of ready-to-use templates to help you build an online store to match your brand. Doesn't matter if it's beautiful, edgy, or minimalist, or, you know, like from the early aughts, like Majority Report. Shopify is packed with AI tools to help you to put together product descriptions, page headlines, even enhance your product photography. Best yet, Shopify helps you with managing inventory, helps you with managing international shipping, processing returns, and beyond. You do something in real life, like a Majority Report show, you can integrate it easily with your inventory from your Shopify store. Plus, you will notice that we are on YouTube now selling our products, probably right under here. And that is by way of Shopify. Super easy to integrate on all the social media platforms. Check it out. Turn your business idea into a cha-ching with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial. Start selling today at Shopify.com/majority. Go to Shopify.com/majority. Shopify.com/majority. Again, we'll put those in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. And lastly, today is also sponsored by, and the timing couldn't come better because this is a great gift for the holidays. And I mentioned that I gave one of these, I'm talking about an Aura frame, to my girlfriend's family. And they have a lot of kids, and they went crazy for these things. Not only all the kids filled it up in about 30 seconds, the picture frame, but they then bought multiple frames. And now they want to give me a frame.
Whoa.
As a gift. And so I was like, wait a second. We got a coupon code for that. But these are great. You with Aura frames, you get unlimited free photos and video. All you do, you download the Aura app, you connect to Wi-Fi, and you can send them photos, videos off your phone, whatever. It doesn't matter. They go into a scroll. You can hear audio on these. And here's the amazing thing. If you want to give it as a gift, you can literally preload the frame with photos without taking it out of the box. You can add from anywhere at any time. So it can show up. It's super easy to use. You plug it in, hooks up to the Wi-Fi, super easy. The photos will show up there for your parents, for your uncles, your aunts, your grandparents. It doesn't matter. For a limited time, visit AuraFrames.com. Get $45 off of Aura's best-selling Carver Matte Frames, named number one by Wirecutter. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com. AuraFrames.com. Promo code MAJORITY. This exclusive Black Friday Cyber Monday deal is the best of the year. So order now before it ends. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. That's promo code MAJORITY. We'll put that link in the podcast and YouTube description. Honestly, that is a great gift. I got all the Aura frames here. Before my mom passed, we had an Aura frame for her. It was a great way to stay connected. It was awesome. All right, quick break. We come back. Murtaza Hussain. We are back, Sam Cedar and Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome back to the program Murtaza Hussain. He is a journalist covering national security and foreign affairs at Dropsite News. And he has written, alongside with Ryan Grimm over at Dropsite, a four-part series. Is it going to be longer than this? Murtaza, you can answer that, about Jeffrey Epstein and I'm not sure how it's so expansive. It's hard to describe it. His odd role in relationship to Israel and Israeli officials and their selling of weapons all around the globe.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on, because just this subject is so important and something which has been talked about so much in the media the last few days, but really the crux of the matter has not really been addressed, which is the fact that Epstein, as we're showing in this series, which is an ongoing series, was somebody who was very much involved in global politics, you could say. He was a fixer and deal maker. The four stories we've done so far, they show Epstein involved in helping seed or you could say orchestrate back-channel diplomacy between the Israeli government and other governments. And the ones we've done so far include Cote d'Ivoire, Syria, and Russia. And we have several other stories. And I'm sorry, Mongolia as well, too. And we have several other stories coming out, I think, in the next few weeks, which will touch on other countries as well. But yes, Epstein was somebody who was very involved in the global arms trafficking trade, the tech, you know, surveillance technology, the profusion of it the last few decades. Obviously, sex trafficking is known, but in many other things, money laundering as well, too. And we're going to dig deeper into that in the months and weeks to come.
Can you back up a little bit to talk about Ghislaine Maxwell's father's connections to Israeli intelligence? Because I think that might be important to understanding, and the arms trade more broadly, to understanding like what Epstein kind of got himself into via this partnership with Maxwell, his daughter.
Right. So Robert Maxwell was somebody who had a very interesting relationship, you could say, with intelligence services. He was sort of an asset to them. He was a very wealthy individual, and he used his connections to play, again, a role as sort of a fixer and someone who could deploy capital for various purposes, which were useful to foreign governments, especially Israel. And, you know, this is something which is speculative in a way, but it's very logical, it seems, that almost that Epstein, upon Maxwell's death, he sort of inherited that role. And when we've seen in a number of different disclosures, I will say there are three so far major sources of information about Epstein that we have gotten recently. One is the House oversight documents, which are being released at the moment. The other are some documents from a lawsuit between the U.S. Virgin Islands and J.P. Morgan, alleging that Epstein was involved in J.P. Morgan and that helped facilitate sex trafficking. And finally, a cache of emails between former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Epstein. And they show Epstein acting a lot like Maxwell did, basically acting as a fixer for Israeli government officials, helping them secure both economic and political interests in foreign countries. And there's a particular model that Epstein appeared to operate on with Barak, whereby the two of them, or often Barak coached by Epstein or guided by Epstein, would approach a foreign country that had security problems and offer them a range of possible solutions, usually involving surveillance technology and other military cooperation, which could be provided by Israeli private firms, which were in fact linked to Israeli intelligence. And once those non-diplomatic commercial and security arrangements start to form, a few years later, the Israeli government would often go in and sign a formal security agreement with that country. And that's what happened in Cote d'Ivoire, that's what happened in Mongolia, that's what happened in many other places. And Epstein was somebody who would, in my opinion, he had more contacts with people around the world, influential people in government and business and so forth, than any one person could really develop or manage organically. He was a central node to so many people in so many parts of the world. In Africa, he had huge connections in the Middle East, in Israel, in Europe, Russia, Central Asia, obviously the United States as well, too. He was at the center of all of it, and he would open doors and make these things happen. And that was really the role he played. And that's not to diminish the importance of his involvement in sex trafficking and the abuses that he was ultimately arrested for. But it seems almost only one part of the full story who Epstein really was.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to reiterate that point that you just made at the end there, because this is not about, diminishing it, but it is his role in the world is fascinating, and it's becoming more and more clear. And it also what this stuff shows me, and then I want to get into sort of a little bit more of the specifics, but that the idea that he was working for the Mossad, I think, would be a mistake to sort of say that. It makes it sound like he was sort of like subservient, like they were his employee. Like, it sounds more like he is a broker, and the idea of these things being discrete things, you know, like this is his job or that's his job, because it sounds like he's more of like a broker in this stuff, which isn't to say that he isn't providing all sorts of information, Mossad, but it sounds like he's almost more senior level in which he's engaging in. And that, to the extent that information gets to the Mossad, it gets through other members of the Israeli government and God knows how many other governments. But let's, you can speak to that as we talk about the story, but your first story was in September 28th, and you referenced the cache of emails between Ehud Barak and Epstein. Where did those come from? Like, the emails we're seeing now came from his estate via subpoena by the Congressional Oversight Committee. Where did those first emails come from?
Yeah, so our first story in September, as you mentioned, about this Israeli security agreement with Mongolia that Epstein was involved in helping put together, that information came from this hacked cache of emails from Ehud Barak. Now, these emails were hacked, it seems like, some years ago. The majority of them are between 2012 2016, and there are a few after that, but the majority of them came from around that time. We don't know exactly who hacked them, but it was claimed by this pro-Palestinian hacking group called Handala, which others have speculated may have had ties to the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence. Again, we're not totally sure, but they were dumped online, and then they were picked up by this organization called Distributed Denial of Secrets, and it's like a successor organization to WikiLeaks, and they have different dumps of data and emails from hacks and leaks all over the world. They're hosted on there. Anyone can go look at them. You can go download them and take a look at them and so forth. And they contain thousands and thousands of emails, like 50,000 emails roughly from Barak. And a few other Israeli officials at the time were also hacked. But in those emails, a subset of them are Barak's communications with Epstein. Now, Barak, people probably know he was Israeli defense minister. He was Israeli prime minister one time. And these emails are mostly from the period of right when he was about to resign as defense minister of Israel. And then,
okay, just so people know, he was prime minister. I mean, he was in the military, obviously, in Israel. He was a general, I think a fairly well-decorated Israeli general, became prime minister, was relative to sort of like Israeli politics, probably like, you know, sort of like a moderate, you know, maybe within the context of Israeli politics, you know, sort of like left of center, but, you know, that's Israeli politics are pretty far to the right. Then became, after he left office, he became a defense minister and then sort of like became, I don't know, a private defense minister, for lack of a better term, right? It's like just heading out and almost like just paying the people who are getting paid by the people or selling to the people who followed him.
Yeah, it's funny, like in the Israeli political spectrum, so Ehud Barak is derided like an extreme leftist or something, which is not really the case, but that's what he's positioned given how things have moved in that direction. But yeah, so, you know, effectively what Barak was doing, as we can see in the emails, is what a lot of American political officials also do, which is that when they leave public office, they try to find ways to make money. They want to make money as private citizens. And we can see in the communications that Epstein was seen by Barak as somebody who could help open doors to make him rich now that he's leaving his defense ministry role in 2013. He actually thanks Epstein in one email. They talk about money pretty much all the time. He thanks him in one email for helping him make a lot of dough, quote unquote. That was a very explicit part of their relationship. But they're also very good friends, and they talk about a lot of things. But Epstein was helping Barak accomplish two goals at once. First was to help take his nascent sort of consultant role off the ground and help him make these connections with foreign countries who would pay him, and, you know, foreign banks would help to give him finder's fees to find them clients and so forth. But in doing so, those connections and those deals that Barak was making would also help further the security interests of Israel and Israeli intelligence. Because what he would do is he'd pitch these Israeli-linked intelligence firms and surveillance firms to foreign countries and foreign governments as a, you know, a turnkey solution to the security problems. And then they would sign these lucrative deals with these Israeli firms, which are almost always founded by veterans of Israeli intelligence. So as we said, Barak was kind of acting as an unofficial sort of, you know, maybe defense minister is the wrong word, but someone who was operating for the benefit of the Israeli government, Israeli security establishment and so forth, while also being free to make money. And Epstein was helping him do the, both those things. He didn't have all the connections Epstein did, which is funny because he was the prime minister.
This what's so bizarre about this is like, how is a random, seemingly random civilian opening up more doors than a former prime minister of, you know, really of any country you would imagine? Like, they'd be able to, like, it's nuts. It almost feels like Epstein is opening doors in the Israeli government too, on some level, to Barak, but it's so strange.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. People have asked this question for a long time, did Epstein work for Mossad? And I totally agree with you, Sam. I don't think he worked for Mossad at all. If anything, it seemed like the Mossad was working for him.
Yes.
Yeah, right. And in the interactions between Barak and Epstein, it's really notable. I've spent a lot of time looking at the emails. There's a clear power dynamic here. And Barak, you know, mind you, at that time was one of the most influential, powerful people in the Israeli political and security establishment. He was looking up to Epstein. It was by no means that Epstein was going after him or trying to get his attention. It was really vice versa. He was eager for Epstein's attention and help and so forth, and as a mentorship, you could say. And Epstein, like I said, he had deep connections and ability to draw influence very much in Africa, very much in the Middle East, very much in Central Asia, Europe, Russia, all these places. You know, there's also some documents were released as part of that lawsuit I mentioned earlier, the J.P. Morgan, U.S. Virgin Islands lawsuit. In those documents, you know, Epstein is talking about getting clearance to meet, like, foreign ministers of pretty much every country you can imagine in the Middle East to have discussions about various matters, economic matters, and so forth. I don't know. He's all talking about meeting Putin. He helped arrange, we reported on this, he helped arrange a meeting and back channel between Ehud Barak and top Russian government officials to discuss a deal to remove Bashar al-Assad from power in 2013. He had unbelievable sway and pull. How he developed that, you know, there's some theories about that. I don't think anyone really knows for sure. But by all means, he was somebody far more powerful than Barack, I would say, and the public officials of most countries. And, you know, he was sort of a free agent. He was he had clear ideological sympathies in certain ways. He had ties to some countries more than others. And some of that is reflected in our reporting, especially related to Israel. But he was somebody who was in many ways more powerful than all those people. And I don't think that, you know, I'll also tell people, I think Israelis are also victims of the situation. Ordinary Israelis are definitely victims of the situation because their country was being used as effectively a base by these people who were making a lot of money and they were doing things which arguably were only in their own interest. Right. And Israel was like a sovereign sort of destination by which from which they could organize that.
But how about Epstein's relationship, too, with Adnan Khashoggi from the arms dealer known for from, obviously, Iran-Contra, too? I mean, I feel like that doesn't necessarily get reported on that much. Or was that more Maxwell's connection?
No, it was definitely also Epstein's connection.
Yeah, yeah.
A very important point because, you know, we're going to write about this more just to contextualize sort of the long history of Epstein. But, you know, Iran-Contra was a very important step in the journey to Epstein becoming who he was and his friendship with Adnan Khashoggi and so forth. You know, my impression is that Epstein was somebody, and he's talked about this, he's bragged, before he died, he bragged about this as well, too. He bragged about his connections to the global arms industry. But also, and he also mentioned diamonds and other things, but he also was somebody who was very involved in money laundering and sophisticated means of money laundering. Which could be beneficial to foreign governments, foreign intelligence agencies, also American intelligence, the American government as well, too, when they wanted to fund certain activities but wanted to keep it away from public scrutiny, they could arrange sophisticated money laundering schemes. And Epstein seemed to be a master of money laundering. And, you know, Adnan Khashoggi was somebody who was very well known for his involvement in this kind of activity. There was an organization called the BCCI. It was a Pakistani-based bank many years ago, known to be very corrupt, had ties to Adnan Khashoggi, was involved in Iran-Contra. Epstein was very much in those circles, and he seemed to learn the tips of the trade doing it at that time. And he blossomed in later years to become a power player in his own right. I think one really important part is we know, you know, certain snippets of Epstein's life. There's a period, you know, around the time from like 2003 to 2010-ish, where his life is completely like a black box. We really don't know much of what he was doing at that time. But I strongly suspect he was very involved in the Iraq War and helping facilitate it or in conversations about it. Not saying he triggered it or anything like that, but, you know, he's somebody who was so deeply involved in every sort of major geopolitical enterprise at the U.S. and Israel and a few other countries that I would imagine that he had some involvement in that, such as he did in other later and previous episodes.
I mean, I have a lot of questions that may be sort of outside of your portfolio with this, because there are like the whole, you know, sort of financial stuff that backs this too. I mean, at one point, maybe years from now, we will have a more holistic vision of what is going on here. Because it really is nuts that this guy is able to sort of like coordinate all these things. But I will say there is a email going around in this latest trove where Epstein talks about Trump basically not just lending his name from a branding exercise, you know, as a way of making money, but also being a Trojan buyer of a lot of stuff for wealthy people who wanted to launder their purchases. I mean, it has occurred to me, again, this is all speculation on my part. You've done a lot more reporting and digging into these things, that when in that birthday card, when he referred to them as both enigmas, I get the sense that that was about money laundering at the end of the day. I mean, I feel like that would be... It feels like Epstein would find a thing that he shared with these different people and then become this mentor, like Larry Summers asking how to,
well, but he
how
has,
to like prey but, on, you know, somebody who works for him.
But a mentor would imply that the relationship isn't coercive. I mean, he also had cameras and surveillance setups throughout his whole house. So, I mean, Murtaza, feel free to weigh in here, but like he recorded, it seems like a lot of incriminating information about.
But it's unclear. I mean, from the email, yeah, Murtaza weigh in on this, but I'm like looking at his Larry Summers stuff, and that does not seem like Larry Summers is afraid of Epstein. It seems like Larry Summers is like, I'm a loser. Can you help me score with this, you know, person who's working for me? I mean, it's nuts. It's like what I feel like, a 12-year-old would say to like, some junior in high school, like, yeah. Dude, how do I, like, it's like Fast Times at Ridgemont High when a guy's saying, put on that Led Zeppelin album, sort of. But Murtaza, weigh in on this.
Yeah, to Emma's point, it's this issue of the blackmail. It's interesting because I think there's very strong circumstantial evidence, and I think it's very plausible that was the case. I haven't seen a smoking gun as yet that he was doing that per se. But, one thing we reported on is that at his the apartments that he was administering in New York, the ones he's renting or you have control over, there was an Israeli senior Israeli military intelligence agent living there for stretches of that time, weeks at a time between 2013, 2015. So one can imagine what the reason for that is. But, and another aspect is that Epstein did have ties to Russian oligarchs. And we've also reported on parts of this. And they were well known to do this kind of thing. The whole compromat idea was sort of in some way pioneered by them. And there are some other emails which suggest, imply that this was going on. But I haven't seen a smoking gun per se. It's very plausible to me. But that said, I also think that a lot of these people, they didn't need to be blackmailed because they were willing to do what Epstein wanted. Anyways, because Epstein was somebody who, they wanted to be close to him because he was someone who could make you a lot of money. He could make you a very wealthy person if you have connection to him. He was someone who was a gateway to a lot of, like, fun, quote-unquote. He could, open doors to parties and God knows what, social circles that are very elite and so forth. So I think that he probably used carrots and sticks, and I've seen a lot of carrots, but we haven't seen necessarily firm evidence that he was doing that, although I think it's not by no means beyond the realm of possible at all. But yeah, he was somebody who was also very charismatic, clearly. He had a magnetic sort of personality. Powerful people were dying to talk to him and work with him or have his attention and have his time and so forth. So, I don't know. That's a very, very important part of who he was and how he operated. And these emails, he was just chatting in a lot of them with powerful people. Like, they were using him as a confidant or somebody who they wanted to, like Larry Summers is a great example. They wanted his help as an individual. So I don't know what the particular, elite culture was where these things were being discussed or what, role exactly he played socially in this way, but it wouldn't surprise me that a lot of people did what he wanted just because they wanted to, even if some of them were also being coerced.
I mean, we should be frank. I mean, some of our faves were involved. Chomsky has written about there's what seems to be some type of like reference letter and where Chomsky talks about the access to insight and individuals in areas where Chomsky was it sounds like Epstein made, maybe it was Ehud Barak, it could have been other Israeli officials, so that Chomsky could sort of formulate his opinions and get an idea of what's actually going on, providing that type of access to somebody who wouldn't necessarily be able to sort of you don't imagine Chomsky having the opportunity, once he becomes such a full-throated critic, to be able to have access and insight from behind whatever, curtain right. that he has criticized. And it's like Epstein shows up and I'm like, I've got, you want reds? I got reds. You want blues? I got blues. I got uppers. I got downers. I got the whole, I got whatever it is that you want. It's like a weird world, but this guy has all the information that people seem to be seeking from him. Now, of course, I'm not reading the emails that are just banal, but it seems really sort of fascinating. I guess the origin story is how it gives you a better sense of what this trajectory is, right?
Yeah, he made himself indispensable to so many people, seemingly. He was able to open doors for them and so forth. And, with Chomsky, it was fascinating because there are some emails between Chomsky Epstein and Ehud Barak in the separate disclosures, which were not from the House Oversight Committee, were then Barak's emails. And it seemed like Epstein and Barak just, they saw Chomsky as like this brilliant curiosity. And they actually, there's one very interesting email. We might report this later on, but there's an interesting email where they're discussing some criticisms that Chomsky had made about the trajectory of the Israeli government, Israeli society. And, you know, they thought, oh, this is actually made some good points here. And they're discussing his article and wanting to meet up with him and so forth. So, you know, I get the impression Epstein really enjoyed being part of these rarefied academic intellectual circles. He saw himself as someone like that as well, too, even if he didn't have any formal affiliation. He obviously had this famous affiliation with all these elite educational institutions. And Chomsky was a legendary figure in them, even putting aside his political views, just as a linguist. So I think that they saw him as somebody who was someone who fit naturally into the social circle. And yeah, what Epstein was doing for Chomsky is really, it's hard to say. Maybe there's nothing, I don't know, but there could have been something as well, too. But there was just something that there was a magnetism there that seemed to people want to be involved with him. And he could arrange funding for people. And we're going to be reporting about this later on. But, you know, people who are in academia and research and science, they need the funding for their projects and so forth. And he was somebody who's very well positioned to provide that, provided that there was something in it for him or he found it to be noteworthy or in line with his own personal or political interests.
Within the context of the Barak emails, were there other figures that you came across aside from Chomsky who ended up being mentioned in these emails as being within the sort of like universe where Epstein operated?
A tremendous number of people all over the world. A lot of them, some of the known names are probably already known right now, but he just had such tremendous reach all over the world. A lot of them are people who may not be familiar to Americans, to be honest. People, senior political figures in Africa and in the Gulf Arab countries and mid-level figures or upper mid-level figures. He was hosting many of them. His house in New York was like an unaffiliated diplomatic embassy. It was a diplomatic embassy for some parastatal force, which he was the ambassador. That's kind of how he operated. So, it was kind of taken as a given that he would be somebody who would be helping facilitate official diplomacy, business deals. He's very involved in the world of private banks. We have a forthcoming story, hopefully in the next 24, 48 hours, about his involvement with a very famous private bank. He would use his relationships to accomplish discrete political ends. And, one thing Epstein would do is he'd always do two things at once. Because whenever he's trying to accomplish a political goal, there would always be a financial component tied into it as well, too. So it was a very, in some way, seamless system that he was sort of operating under. And, he was somebody who was above all these governments. He seemed to represent a class of people who were above all these governments from all over the world. They knew each other. They invested together. It was not really a huge world of people, to be honest. And when you look at those photos that the New York Times released in his mansion, you see like he was with the Emiratis and Israelis and British people and Americans and Russians. He had a tremendous reach and tremendous influence. And I think that it's just a little odd, actually, if you think of how did one individual who's a private citizen develop all that. Who did he work for? What influence did he represent? He certainly worked for himself, but, there's something beyond that as well, too. I think that, if I were to put a rough point, that there's like a global billionaire class, and he is somebody who was a very important node in that global billionaire class. That's who I would say Epstein was, in the short and sum of it. And alongside that, he had relationships with all these governments and intelligence agencies while not working for them, per se.
Do we have a sense of like, I mean, the first thing occurs to me is like, I just the sheer amount of social connections the guy has, business, social connections, whatnot, like, I can't even like it. I just don't understand how that works. Like, when do you have time to do anything? And, but do we have a sense that there was any type of apparatus Like, I know Ghislaine Maxwell was his number two and must have had a big portfolio, if you will. But part of that portfolio also seems to be sort of like organizing the sex trafficking. Like, here he is. You've written stories about him going to, you know, to Cote d'Ivoire and to Mongolia and to Syria. And, you know, presumably he's got other clients. He's also like seems to have a burgeoning money laundering business. Like all these things coincide. They all seem to sort of like mix in with each other on some level. But is there any like evidence of an apparatus? Like, has he BCC'd anybody? Has he CC'd anybody? Like, I this is what I, you know, like I can barely like organize what we're doing here. And I just don't understand how does he keep in his head, like, got to get to the Cote d'Ivoire because we're going to sell, this weapon system. But of course, we got this thing in Mongolia where we're going to do these security things. And I've got to, create a fake bank account in, you know, I don't know, the Bahamas. Like, I don't, like, is there any sense that there's an apparatus that he's running? Or who's doing, like, the grunt work?
You know, it's really great you bring that point up, because if you look at his schedule to release as part of these House oversight disclosures, you know, he had, I don't know where he found the time to do the sex trafficking, actually, based on his schedules, because he was meeting people morning to night, traveling constantly. As you said, arranging these very intricate discussions and very important sort of geopolitical back channels and so forth. It's very interesting. Like, and his schedule was put together by his assistant, Leslie Groff, at the time. They would sort of manage what he was doing day to day, per se. But you're right. It's difficult. You know, an organization would need to usually do this much, and it'd be difficult for an organization to actually execute this much just bureaucratically, or keeping all this information together, keep all these different projects going at the same time. What, if anything, was managing that? I don't know. It's I can't say right now what was happening. He could have hired a staff. Supposedly, he did have a staff, a significant staff who worked for him. So he could have been an organization unto himself. But I completely agree with you that the nature of his lifestyle and his contacts and the way he managed them and so forth was inorganic, in the sense that no one individual could do all of this. No one individual could manage all these contacts, all these different projects, leaving totally aside the illegal sex trafficking he was involved in. Just his geopolitical maneuvering was seemingly far beyond the purview of any one individual. Maybe he was superhuman. Maybe he just did it himself. I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think that it's just, it wouldn't make a lot of sense. And yeah, he had a staff, but even then, something doesn't add up here. So, you know, I'll say, whenever I talk about Epstein, I say that, you know, this is a situation, it's like the analogy of the blind person and the elephant. Like, everyone is touching one aspect of the elephant, but no one sees the full elephant. We're all like, you know, I'm touching one part, and then the New York Times is touching some part, which I find less relevant and so forth, and stuff like that. But, you know, we don't have the full picture. And I hope that we do develop the full picture over time. But, you know, it's going to take a tremendous amount of disclosure and attention and evidence and reporting dedicated to actually uncovering the full scope of who he was and what he was involved in.
Well, also the Maxwell thing, I just feel like is still underreported. Like, her role is as being his number two, maybe not. There's a lot of focus, of course, on her basically recruiting these girls for him to abuse, and literally driving around schools in West Palm Beach and doing that. I mean, it's horrific. But as I mentioned earlier about Robert Maxwell and his ties to the arms trade and to Israeli intelligence, like, he died mysteriously in the middle of the ocean, got pushed off or fell off his boat. I think that was what happened. Maybe he didn't get pushed off. We don't know. It just didn't happen. Lots of mysterious stuff happening around the story. But like, how much did Epstein take over? Ghislaine was his favorite, his baby daughter, the boat was named after her that I think that he died on. And it seemed like a lot of people that observed their relationship seemed like she replaced this very intense relationship with her father with Epstein. And it would make sense if he took over business contacts for Robert Maxwell, right?
But even still, I would imagine, Hi, I'm that guy that you did that that arms deal with. I'm his brother, and you know, is yeah. like his stepson. So let's do this. That also just seems like click. I mean, like, but getting. I want you to address that, but getting back just to the staff thing, has anybody gone out and like attempted to sort of unwind or pull on the thread of any of the names that were working in the staff? Like, I would imagine there's got to be like NDAs, but you know, the guy's dead. And unless there's some, like, why wouldn't you, even if you got paid off, which I would imagine they all got paid quite well, you would imagine that one of them would speak unless they were afraid of like there being some other way of there's being some other mechanism to punish them for speaking out about it.
Yeah. You know, there have been some limited sort of reporting of people who work with him, security people, assistants, people who worked on staff at his mansion. You know, it has not been very substantive. Some of them have passed away, like, you know, natural causes, I guess, but, you know, it's been what I've called kind of a limited hangout a little bit. The term people may know, that intelligence term. There've been like a little bit of reporting about all these things, but the thread has never fully unraveled the whole way. And it's not always clear how much any one individual may have known about this situation. But I do think, you know, I'm a really important point. Like take the one aspect, the sex trafficking that Ghislaine was involved in. You know, there are people who knew about that, and the people in the staff who testified that they cleaned up at his mansion after these, you know, abuses took place and so forth. Again, I don't know how Epstein learned how to do that or decide to integrate that into his larger apparatus. One thing that does go back to Robert Maxwell, and beyond that is the ties to BCCI. Because that bank, BCCI, which was this notorious global money laundering institution, they were very well known for sex trafficking, and they would traffic girls from Asia and South Asia to the Middle East, and that was part of their money laundering apparatus. It seemed like there's a class of people all around the world who were involved in this type of activity, whom Robert Maxwell was an integral part. And then by some means, it seems, though, that Epstein inherited, and this would just be a natural thing that they knew to do, or they knew that their clients, whoever they were, would demand this, or political expediency would demand this. And he just sort of was able to fulfill that role, you know, given who he was and whose connections were and so forth. So, you know, it's interesting because there are people who talk about this, and a lot of this stuff is public, and we are getting some disclosures about this. There's our reporting, there's a House Oversight Committee, and victims of sex trafficking have testified, members of the staff has testified in the past, but it doesn't really, you know, the whole thing does never get put together. Even these emails that are coming out right now, they're really interesting, but they're all like, what individual, you know, shotgun-like blasts in different directions, and the whole thing is not really put together in a cohesive whole. They're really shocking, like, implications in many of these emails, and shocking implications of things people have said in the past, too. But what does it all add up to? That's the question which has not really been fully answered.
What from the email trove of Ehud Barak was the most shocking to you? I mean, was it a series of stuff like where you're like, oh my God, wait, what? And like, it feels like that could have been like a rolling experience of like, how is Epstein, like, you know, dealing with the Russians in Syria and then also going to, you know, Mongolia? And like, it's just bizarre. But what did you find most sort of surprising or shocking?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the emails are all there and like anyone can look at them, but it's not obvious what are being said in the emails per se, because this is like a snapshot of a particular time in both men's lives. It doesn't account for when they first met. It doesn't account for, you know, it's like you're joining the story mid-conversation in a way in a lot of these cases. So it's only really after putting together the thread of what they're talking about each of these cases that, you know, you come to some revelation that something very significant was happening here. So it takes a lot of time to look at them to actually determine that. It's definitely doable. It's just, you know, it's an investment of resources and so forth, which I guess is a barrier to just reporting them easily. It's not like low-hanging fruit per se, even though they are available. But, you know, I think it's fascinating the casualness of all this, actually, in a way, because You know, one would think that back-channel diplomatic conversations were handled through some sort of quasi-official channels and so forth. It was really often just certain individuals who were very plugged in, who were part of these elites organically, who arranged these talks, which Epstein was doing for Barack in many, many parts of the world. But I think that, if not shocking, but the most revealing email in there is one we've quoted several times in the story. I think we'll continue quoting because it kind of tells the whole story in a way. It's one where Epstein just emailed Barack out of the blue, seemingly. They just chatted very often with their friends. And he said, you know, all over the world, in Somalia and Syria and Ukraine and all these places, there are this great upheaval and people in power are very insecure and afraid. Isn't this perfect for you? And Barack responds, yes, but it's not easy to turn it into a cash flow, something for us to discuss on Saturday. So it seemed like the two of them were looking at the map of the world. Epstein had contacts pretty much everywhere, saying who's insecure, who needs help that we could provide them or sell them, and then using Barack as the guy who go do the pitch with Epstein's encouragement. So I think that email sort of is the distilling the broader little operation they were running in this case. They were exploiting global upheaval as a means of making money and then also furthering security interests of certain states, and particularly in this case, Israel.
It's hard because, you know, like this stuff really sort of pulls at that thing in your brain where you just want to go to like the most sort of like conspiratorial thing. But the way I saw that email, I mean, it's in your pieces, obviously. But it really feels to me like that is Epstein trying to get him on the hook. Like the idea, like there's a lot of opportunity out there for you, buddy. And Barack is like, yeah, I know, but I can't make it happen. It sort of feels like that's Epstein's way of saying, well, I can help you make it happen. And then, you know, there's this and this and this and, you know, like.
And Barack, we should say, it's heavily implied by in Virginia Giuffre's, I believe, accounts that he might have been the prime minister that assaulted her. Is that, that's accurate, right?
Yeah, there's nothing about that in the emails per se, but I have seen that reporting and I did see her statements about that. She said the certain prime minister did that. I think the New York Post heavily implied it was him. I don't have any definitive information about that, but
Say how interweave it woven, like the, what the, all these financial dynamics are with the sex trafficking too. Sorry,
I would imagine like that's part of it. It's like we're in this, dude. Like, you know, we go hang out. You know, we go to the strip club together on a regular basis, and you know, us doing business. You know, that type of like sort of dynamic where it's like we're all in on this, and it does that. Him emailing Barack out of the blue and saying there's a lot of opportunity out there seems solicitous to me in some way.
Yeah. So this is 2014. So they'd already known each other and been close for some years now. And they'd already done the deal or initiated the deal with Mongolia and Cote d'Ivoire, at least at this point, and other countries as well, too. So they, you know, and, you know, to Emma's point, it's a really important point because all these communications, they don't talk about the sex trafficking aspect at all, so far as I've seen. But that's a subtext. We know what's happening. We know what's been going on. He'd been involved in that. He'd been convicted many, many years before that, the first time for that. So it's something which is an unspoken sort of additional layer in this onion that, you know, it does implicate the broader suggests, you know, a broader meaning behind their communications. And, you know, Epstein, you know, if you look at the way he talks to different people, he talks to everyone sort of in a different way, so to speak. He kind of tells them not what they want to hear, per se, but he would sort of project a certain image back at them, which was conducive to what their interests were, their desires were, and so forth. He definitely has a markedly different communication style with different types of people. So, you know, it makes sense that in Barack's case, you know, he helped make Barack a very wealthy person. And I think these emails show the whole process of that happening in a way. And, you know, Barack, he had certain political inclinations, he had a desire to make money, he had other things going on maybe, and his communication with Epstein seems to evince a knowledge of all that and how to continue to get him along that that process.
Lastly, did it occur to you, like, reading these emails, like, what is this dude doing using Gmail for all this? Like, it's sort of like, that's the other thing, it's like, it's like, they're doing all this over like CompuServe or AOL. It just seems so like Epstein feels like he doesn't have to worry about anybody finding this stuff out because there's almost a sense of like, who are they going to report me to? Like,
yeah,
I got like, I'm untouchable. It sort of feels like
that was the lesson he also got out of this 2007 non-prosecution agreement, was like, just basically, I am untouchable, right? That would make sense and line up with this timeline, right?
Yeah, I think there was a great sense of impunity reigning at that time. Not to say that they whined on one of his emails or thought maybe it was not possible, but you know, given the 2008 agreement, given a lot of things, and given the way he lived and the people around him lived, I don't think that they felt necessarily a great fear from the public or fear from accountability of any sort. So it's not just him who was using the Gmail, like Barack was using the Gmail, and other very powerful people, Americans and others, were using like AOL and Hotmail and so forth. This is 2014, 13, around that time, and these people from an older generation who may have been less acclimated at that time to the whole concept and so forth. You know, it was very cavalier. And I think if you look at the later communications, especially the House disclosures, which are more recent in time, 2019, 2018, like that, he does seem to become a bit more cagey. And he says more often that certain things should only be discussed on the phone and so forth. But he's still using his Gmail. He's still using that to communicate with these very powerful people. So, you know, that's a
And
very,
we should
very...
say this is after, like, it's not like, you know, like Petraeus got, I think he was, I don't know if he was convicted, but he was prosecuted because, you know, they found that he was doing that draft thing with the Gmail where I think it was his girlfriend slash reporter who was writing about him. They would communicate by just sharing a Gmail account and writing back and forth just in drafts. So it was never actually even emailed out. And they still were able to find that. So it's not like, you know, it's not like my dad going like, wait, what? They can look at AOL emails? Really? Like, you know, the guy has some savvy. It's just as if he just thinks he has impunity on some level.
You know, I think that sense of impunity kind of goes to, it's like a very important part of the whole story, because even the sex trafficking and the criminality and so forth, not just Epstein, but a lot of these people, they seem to believe that they were somehow above all sort of legality and morality and propriety and so forth. That's just the broader impression I get from their broader range of activities. Like even the use of an island and all the, you know, spectacularly illegal and immoral things that are going on there. It just seemed like there's no way that anybody could possibly see what we're doing or stop us, or the idea of us being stopped is simply impossible. That's just a tremendous amount of hubris, I would say, which is in the emails, not just with Epstein, by the way, many, many other people. And when you get that level of hubris, you can make mistakes and you can become cavalier in a way which could be injurious later on. That's what they seem to be operating as, though. And I would say that I get the impression that that culture still exists, and maybe Epstein was taken down for some reason, but that broader global elite culture, and you see it like all over the world, that's very, very much prevalent. And, you know, this is just one glimpse into it, and who knows what's going on right now.
I think at the end of the day, that is probably like the biggest takeaway from this is the sort of there is a cohort of people living amongst us, but they're not living amongst us. They are operating under an entirely different set of rules. And it explains a lot of times their decision-making, because I think, you know, more than anything else, at least in the context of the sex trafficking, these are not people who I think even contemplated the idea that like, well, I'm doing sex trafficking. I mean, I think they were aware that they could break laws, and there's some emails from Epstein that suggest, you know, Dershowitz was getting information to see like what the specific laws were, but they clearly didn't look at these girls or women as, you know, as human beings. They were just, you know, these are all, and I think that across the board, it's like, we're humans and everything else is just sort of like things for us to exploit in some fashion. Murtaza Hussein, we will link to your pieces in on DropSite. And look forward to more of these coming out. It is there's so much to this story, and again, I think it really speaks to sort of a an elite perspective on the world that we, as just mere humans, don't know much about it. But appreciate your time today.
Hey, thank you both for having me on. Appreciate
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head to the fun half.
Yes.
Wherein you can IM the show if you're a member, and we will read your IMs. We may take some phone calls. We will have some fun out on the trail, as it were. Don't forget, you can join us there by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And perhaps even more importantly, you help this show survive and thrive. Your support is what keeps this show independent. And, you know, we don't always say the stuff that our members or our audience wants us to, but, you know, at least we're saying it because we believe it and we don't get necessarily a benefit from saying it. Also, Just Coffee, although with that said, here's an ad. JustCoffee.coop. Although I do actually genuinely love this coffee, and I really do love this company. Just Coffee has been a sponsor of this show, or even the one preceded it, the Break Room Live, for 20 years. Or 18, or I don't know. Some math problem. But JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee. They're a co-op in Madison, Wisconsin. They sell a Majority Report blend, but they also have all sorts of single origin. And if you use the coupon code Majority, you get 10% off. Matt, Left Reckoning or the Jacobin Show.
Yeah, actually, folks on YouTube can go over to Jacobin's YouTube channel and, of course, watch the first episode of the Jacobin Show with David Griscom and I. But also, folks, to check out the link here. You can get 4 print issues of Jacobin for just $10 or a year-long digital access for $5 by using the code there. Whoa. So if a lot of people decide today's the day they need to do their Jacobin subscription, I would be much
That's
obliged.
That's the way to get it.
If you did it through that link.
Let's just scroll up a little bit. There's a couple of things I noticed. First off, you know what it is? I love that wave at the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
That is super cool.
Yeah. As a
also,
graphic, it's minimalist, but it gets the job done.
Now, does Griscom get a little bit upset that he seems to actually, like, groom himself for the show, and then you just seem to, like, show up?
So we're on different timelines when it comes to that, but I'll just say, like...
So Griscom is, like, moving forward into
at a faster
middle
pace.
Age.
Yeah, at a faster pace, and that's actually an improvement if you clock it over the previous
You did
episode.
Look... You look like you shaved there.
I did shave. I am still wearing my basic Hanes t-shirt. My nice like four for $20 pack there, but yeah, you know, we're upgrading. So
Griscom's got, like, he's got prints in the back, he's got a sport coat on, he's got a bookshelf.
Well, he's the main host for the Jacobin Show too, okay, so I'm just a producer in the background.
I got you. Okay.
Who weighs in whenever he wants. Yeah, best of both worlds for Matt. Very similar to what you do here.
That's awesome. You can wear whatever you want.
H. John Cedar. Hey, I ordered an M-Majority shirt, and the expected delivery date was last week. Is there a way to get a tracking number? I will look into that.
Probably hasn't shipped yet. Didn't we say that it was it's a pre-order, so it was going to come around Thanksgiving? I thought that was what...
Yes,
that
is correct.
Yeah, so I just think maybe just a little bit of patience, and then we'll see. Hopefully it'll come soon.
Folks, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts!
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Unpacked. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who?
Unpacked. What is up, everyone?
Unpacked.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start
life. Libertarian.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. The Thera gaffe. The rage half. What do you think about the fact that even Charlie Kirk began publicly calling Epstein a Mossad agent just weeks before his assassination? Do you think that upset Netanyahu? It's possible that Netanyahu would track everything that Charlie Kirk would say and thinks that everything that Charlie Kirk would say would have huge sway over the country, but I highly doubt that.
I'm just not on board with that, with this theory. Like, I think that it's almost certain that Epstein was working with Mossad or working with Israeli intelligence. That's been established. But like, the idea that Charlie Kirk would be the one that Israel would take out, he was one of their strongest soldiers. Besides that one comment.
I mean, but what is it like? What is it that people thought was going to happen? Like, you know, yeah. Charlie Kirk had been doing what he was doing for at least a decade.
Yeah.
And it is true within the Trump circles that he was extremely helpful, I think, to getting Trump elected. And I do think he had a massive audience. But like, Joe Rogan has a bigger audience. Joe Rogan, like the idea, like it says, I don't know what he said about Epstein, but he said all sorts of freaking things. Like, I just, it's unclear to me why people think there was such stakes as to, it's quite possible that Charlie Kirk, you know, was going to sort of like do a, a 180 or a 90 degree or a 180 on his support for Israel.
Because Fuentes was eating his lunch on it.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. But like, if you're Israel, why, if, and that was your concern, like, why wouldn't you look at the environment and go like, you know what we could do if we wanted to subtract somebody from this? It would be like, who's causing Charlie Kirk, who's nipping at his ankles? Like, it doesn't logically make sense that there was such value to him that exactly. would be the reason that if we take this piece off the board, it's going to be easy for us. Right. I mean,
it's the lamest
Israel has a lot of problems right now around the world in the way that people perceive them. And it seems like that role was not in any way slowed by the killing of Charlie Kirk.
It's just doing cui bono from like 3,000 feet, and it's not actually that interesting. Like it and frankly, does a disservice to actually good assassination conspiracies like the JFK one that gets into the nuts and bolts of like, oh, yes. Why was Lee Harvey Oswald on the Atsugi Air Force Base in Japan years ago? As opposed to this is like, oh, Israel wouldn't probably like he said that thing that his base definitely wants him to say about Epstein.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not like I feel like that talk is particularly destructive or is at a cost to any agenda that I'm in favor of. Like, I'm like, yeah, go. I think the entire my suggestion would be if I had a show that had any right-wing audience, I would spend every day talking about this and talking about how Trump's not releasing the files, or if he is going to, he's in favor of the House releasing the files, it's only because he knows the Senate's going to do it. And if the Epstein files come out and Trump's not implicated, I wouldn't trust it. I think they should be spending as much time as possible talking about this, frankly. Mm-hmm. Get your clicks and make your money and find the truth. It is out there. It is out there.
But I resent people crediting Charlie Kirk with courage that he did not have in life.
Yes.
Well.
Stolen valor.
You know. It all comes out in the wash. That's what I say. Well, not all. There we go.
Oh, yeah. Love seeing that. It's a particularly disgusting color as well.
It's because of this freaking thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. It looks like curry.
No, it's yellow.
It's
the perfect spot.
It's
you don't
orange.
Get a perfect spot circle like that.
Like, actually, no. Put that up. That's not yellow. Put it up to the camera and then put the yellow next to it. It's orange, bro.
Yeah, every bro. American what happens when you put yellow and blue together? Hello? Look at your primary color wheel.
Okay.
You could just color a new spot.
Kids
right next
today,
to it.
They don't even learn the basics.
Right. I guess you're right. It's me okay. who has a problem.
It is. Listen, the date today is November 17th.
Yes.
Friday was November 14th.
Mm-hmm.
This clip is from Friday, November 14th. And according to my calendar, November 10th is the day would be like 4 weeks out from when Trump was yeah. juiced.
We have Trump period calendar on there.
I have a Trump period calendar on my phone. I also have one here where he's ovulating, just in case. And so November 10th goes by. We hear no report of him having a medical visit. Now, you recall, in October 10th, he had his second annual in 6 months that we knew of. And for a while he had like a problem right here. He was covering up with makeup on his hand.
Yeah.
Now I haven't seen any more pictures of his hands lately. It's unclear.
I think they found a new entry.
It's possible. But then, so I'm like, oh, okay, maybe that was just a coincidence. He had two physicals, mm-hmm. two annual physicals in 6 months.
Right.
Sometimes I go through JAGs where I'm like, I got to get my teeth. I got to go to a dentist, every 3 months because I'm afraid of losing my teeth. And I'm out of that, thankfully. Now it's too expensive. And Then we see this video from Friday.
So why you needed to get an MRI? I understand that the results were good, but what was it for?
Because it's part of my physical. Getting an MRI is very sad. Well, you think I shouldn't have it? Other people got it.
I had an MRI.
Here's what the story is. I had an MRI. The doctor said it was the best result he has ever seen as a doctor. That's it. But I had an MRI as part of my standard yearly, or every, I think they do it every 2 years, but I have the physical every year. And the result was outstanding. Did you know? I have no idea what they analyzed, but whatever they analyzed it well, and they said that I had as good a result as they've ever seen.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things to unpack here. First off, he has an MRI as part of his annual physical, or maybe it happens every 2 years, but this is the third annual physical he's had in 3 months.
It's a three-parter.
It's a three, but they spread it out every month. So it's a rolling annual physical.
It's super standard to have MRIs over and over and over again, month over month.
I probably just want to test the machine to see what a perfect result looks like.
Although yes. I will say, like, there's this...
But how do you assess if you have a perfect MRI relative to what? Like, how could a completely healthy person have a better MRI than somebody else?
I'm not sure, but Trump has found a way to do it. There's like, I don't know if you've noticed this, but influencers are now promoting MRI machines on Instagram, like Real Housewives that I've followed, even actresses and stuff like that. It's like, get your MRI today, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that's just a bit of an aside.
Looks like in MRI results are not usually described as perfect. Usually they're described as normal, unremarkable, or no acute abnormalities.
Well, that's
detected.
What I'm saying. Like, you're basically saying, like, we found so much nothing. This was the most nothing we ever found.
Wow, this is so good.
I just wanted to try a special lens today to see if I could get even clearer images. And this looks great. This is the best looking MRI I've had. Look, there is reasons why you might get an MRI if you wanted to assess how a monoclonal, I think it is, treatment for Alzheimer's was going, right? Because theoretically, I think if you had a brain scan, you might be able to, but I don't know.
How often would you be getting said monoclonal infusion for Alzheimer's?
That would be monthly.
That's so interesting.
Every American will soon receive their own MedMen card.
There you go.
If only those were ready, because he could get card number one, and that would cure all of this.
He doesn't need it. It was a perfect MRI. He's the only one who doesn't need
it. No, I'm just waiting, because I don't need a med bed, because I'm so, so healthy.
It's the most perfect pee test I've ever taken.
I wonder what the how long that stuff works.
Apparently about 47 hours, because he was falling asleep.
I'm saying, like, if you, I would imagine, I mean, my experience with Alzheimer's in terms of my mother is that you don't reverse stuff, but you can slow its roll dramatically.
Yep.
If you have the resources. And so it's unclear, what. I don't know, but, who knows? You know, it's also like, if I was president of the United States, I will tell you right now, I would get a monthly physical. That's what I would use it for. I would be like,
hey. Would you also, if you were the kind of guy that could pass a cognitive test with flying colors, would you maybe perhaps be able to remember why you got an MRI?
It's just par for
the course. Whatever they analyzed it well.
I'm not too worried about it.
It's called protective.
Prophylactic
MRI. Well, no, people do that.
No, I know. But, well. I was just...
Yeah, Emma.
Yeah, sorry.
People do that, okay? Sorry.
I had the Epstein files removed from my body. I used the brain technology so I could forget everything.
Yes.
It looks like you should update your schedule to 4 weeks, not a month.
Right. Listen,
in the period calendar.
Yeah, so right. Every 4 weeks. Well, that's also, yeah.
I know.
Oh, is that also a period schedule?
I really do like, I want to further the idea that Trump is on his, is on, and we're tracking his cycle.
I'm synced up with the moon.
Yep.
I will.
As are the most fertile women.
I'm trying to see. I think I have it for repeating every month, but I should switch it to every 4 weeks. I'll do that.
Watch Harry Emden.
4 weeks. There you go. Look at that. We're just going to do it on the... God, technology is fantastic.
This is surveil your president cycles.
Yep. He's insanity proof, though. You remember that mob boss who would walk around the Greenwich Village in a bathrobe?
BJ's, yeah.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
That's, you could never tell if he's faking it or not because exactly. He's so insane.
That is, in some ways, his trump card, not to do too many puns in the show.
Ben Shapiro spent his first term arguing that he was incapable of, what was it, like, intent? He was so insane, he was not
right.
Possible. He couldn't intend to do anything.
Right, do you really think that Trump could have manufactured this plot? It's like, why does it even matter? And also, isn't that an indictment on the political candidate that you have at the top of your party?
Nicola says, Sam, it's important to be careful with comparing Alzheimer's and especially important to know that there's multiple types of dementia for multiple reasons. As someone who works with dementia patients, though I'm not a doctor, the variation, even with people who have the same diagnosis, is something you can't take for granted. Indeed.
He's getting angrier with reporters and stuff, which is also in line.
Well, that's also, I think, also a function of, like, he's got to be upset about the Epstein stuff. Whatever it is that's in there, and it may be about the child sex trafficking stuff, but it could also be about finances. You know, like one of the things, like in the emails that Epstein said was, and it could be both, that Epstein said was like, you know, Trump, he's again, he had mentioned him being a money launderer, not having real money. And in fact, I think in his emailing with a former Obama lawyer, I can't remember her name off the top of my head at the moment. He said, like, I think this stuff, I think maybe it was to her that this stuff about, like, he doesn't have this real kind of money. Because you remember, the big thing they pushed in 2016 was, like, he's not a real billionaire. And if it was about the fact that he was sort of like doing some money laundering, their thinking was probably like, we can't come out and say he's a money launderer. We can't even necessarily investigate him in the run up to the presidency because that would be inappropriate. But maybe we can say he's not a billionaire to scare him into like, you know, thinking that we're hot on his trail. I mean, you know, it's hard to know, but there could be other stuff in there about his finances. Who knows?
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah, there was one email. I can't find it now, but it mentioned Hyatts and how guys like Trump become sort of like money laundering icons because you become famous. You can sort of work these financing deals out a lot easier.
Well, that's the email I'm talking about. He's comparing Hyatt to just being the branding on one side.
Right.
But he also says that Trump will be a Trojan buyer for properties that wealthy people who are laundering money don't want their names associated with. So Trump will own it in name, but it's really owned by other people, and he gets a little basically like vig for the whole thing, and that's it.
Well, it would make sense with some other theories we've bandied about you know, Trump, not why he wasn't locked up in the period before running for office, despite having all of these money laundering connections and deeply corrupt business ties that were already made evident. If you're cooperating with the government, that makes it a little less likely that they're going to prosecute you on those kinds of things. But go on.
That's what people are saying about the dog that didn't bark.
Yeah.
That Epstein was saying, it's interesting that we're not hearing from Trump right now. He's probably the leaker. In fact, here is that's what we were contemplating the other day. And this clip, this is number 10. Epstein biographer Barry Levine on CNN. This is him talking about the that email where Epstein writing to Maxwell says that Trump is the dog that hasn't barked. And of course, as you know, that Matt, because he's as literary as Jeffrey Epstein, knows that that was a...
I don't like that comparison.
One of the many things you have in common with
I'll just say I'm more literate than Jeffrey Epstein.
You're as also handsome as Jeffrey Dahmer.
Also live in New York.
Yeah, a lot of things. Interesting. Anyways, but that it's from a famous Sherlock Holmes story where a dog did not set off the alarm because they knew the thief, I guess it was. And the idea here is that Trump is not speaking on some level because he knows who the person who tipped off the authorities to about Epstein was.
Why would I bark? I know those guys.
Not just don't I know, guys. I'd be reporting on me. Here is the Epstein biographer.
On that 2011 email, we'll put it up on the screen, and I will ask you, the dog that hasn't barked is Trump. What do you think he's referring to?
Well, I think Jeffrey Epstein is referring to the fact that he believes that Donald Trump talked to Michael Reiter, who was the Palm Beach police chief, in 2004 and began the first investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. I suspect that Jeffrey Epstein, in his conversation or email with Maxwell, was saying he was 75% there, believing that Trump might have been the whistleblower at the time. Again, you have to remember that particular year, the two men had a falling out, not only over the fact that Ghislaine Maxwell was taking young women from his spot, Mar-a-Lago, for Jeffrey Epstein, but they also had a nasty real estate deal that both men were trying to get. So there was bad blood between the two of them.
Okay, so it's a combination then of the Trump being the dog who didn't bark and that additional line on that email. We'll put it back on the screen. Police chief, et cetera, I'm 75% there, meaning he's 75% there to believing that Trump is an informant against him?
That is what I believe based on my research of years of the Jeffrey Epstein story.
Okay,
the House Speaker at one point.
Barry, if Donald Trump were an informant, if Donald Trump dropped the dime on Jeffrey Epstein, why wouldn't he today in this climate be shouting it from the mountaintops? I'm the one who put him away.
That's a question that only the president can answer. And again, the Palm Beach police have never said that Donald Trump was an informant. However, not too long ago, the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, said that Donald Trump was an informant on this particular case. So it is rather confusing.
Well, I mean, so I saw Julie Brown, who was like the Miami Herald reporter who's most across this, saying that, you know, she doesn't believe that Trump would have been the informant to tip off the police. They were tipped off by a parent, which I think like that can also be true. And also, there could have been this pre-existing relationship that Trump had with the government as an informant in other contexts that Epstein could have been aware of, and he could have
deal. Yeah.
You know what? It's also weird to me is just like
on that 2011 email.
The weird thing to me too is why would Epstein want a piece of real estate so much that he would alienate himself from Trump? Like, if this guy is like, he's got all the money in the world, he seems to have access to everything, why would you alienate yourself from anybody in that instance, right? I mean, I guess like over, you know, a material thing like that. I don't know. I mean, which is not to say, like, I think they're impossible. Psychos. It's impossible to sort of like get into the mindset.
But remember what Mike Johnson said like 4 or 5 weeks ago?
Yeah, he said he was an FBI.
If you said
that's
that.
That's what Smirkanish was referencing.
Okay,
that's
gotcha.
What, I mean, the guy was referencing.
Yes,
there.
Okay.
And
okay.
So who knows? I mean, who knows? It's also possible that Trump squealed on him when they came to him. Like, do you know anything? Yes. I mean, who knows?
Did you ever see the movie The Anderson Tapes?
No.
Okay. Well, it's a 1971 movie, Sidney Lumet. But basically, like, there's this heist that happens. And it turns out that the place that they have a heist, there's a whole bunch of surveillance equipment in the basement of it for, like, 3 different investigations. And they can't prosecute the heist people because it would expose all of the recording they're
doing.
I will
tell you something.
Of people in the building.
I think that is the story with many, many conspiracies. So, for instance, like the Benghazi stuff, I think there was, and this is complete speculation on my part, but I think that annex in Benghazi was in fact like shipping armaments to Syria. You can't, but it could have been anything. That's top secret. So the Republicans know that the real answer can't come out. So they can never be proved wrong in any type of theory that's associated with it. I am quite convinced that there is stuff coming out of the New York FBI office in the summer of 2016. The stories about the mutiny and Comey's, and like, I'm convinced that much of the whole Mueller investigation had to stay away from a big quadrant of stuff. And therefore, if there is an answer and you can't say that answer, then you start to backfill with all sorts of other
Warren Commission.
Yes. I mean, I think like if there is an answer that you cannot, and it may not be even that nefarious per se, but it just can't be said for whatever reason. Then all of a sudden, like, if it can't be that answer, then you have to sort of fit a round peg into a square hole.
Although in terms of like, it may not be that nefarious, I do think that like we are reaching a point where we're reckoning a bit with like what our intelligence apparatus turned into in the back half of the 20th century, and then like was put on steroids with the war on terror. And it might be very nefarious in many of these instances, too. Like, I just can't rule that out, given the fact that, you know, what we see with this Epstein stuff indicates a network of influence that we are still scratching the surface of.
Yeah. But I think, like, honestly, I think it's above intelligence agencies. I really do think, like, as Murtaza said, it seems more like the Mossad is working for him than he's working for the Mossad.
But if you see how, like, the OSS and our, intelligence agencies and their connections with Sullivan and Cromwell and money and capital, like, capital was running the day back at the outset of the CIA. It's very similar if they're doing the same thing with Mossad.
Well, and they still have like certain cowboys that are empowered above and beyond even a typical like CIA or a asset that are allowed to do like insane things that, you know, get like a hunt throughout the entirety of like Watergate and all that stuff. Like, they're psychos.
And as the importance of oil in the Middle East and drilling there, and as those kind of Western oil tycoons grew in prominence in U.S. politics, and Israel and our intelligence outposts there became increasingly more prominent, like that timeline makes total sense as well in terms of where money was growing and then where eventually it became ossified and so significant that it had this like international sway with our politics.
This is bizarre too. I mean, I think this just sort of speaks to the level of like Epstein was everywhere. This is Washington Post reporting on this, that there were documents reviewed by the Post that indicate during a 2019 hearing where Michael Cohen was on the stand. He was Trump's former attorney, and he's testifying about Trump. Jeffrey Epstein was texting with Delegate Stacey Plaskett. She is a Democrat from Virgin Islands. Virgin Islands, I think, do not actually get full voting privileges in Congress, but they send a delegate, and she was on the committee that was interviewing Michael Cohen, and she's getting texts from him, and he is like sort of almost like feeding her questions or line of questions. Watch this video. It's really sort of nuts.
Oh, and just for a sec, we should probably say that his Little St. James, the island where he abused those girls, was in the territory of the U.S. Virgin Islands. It's southeast of St. Thomas.
So they matched the text and the video feeds in terms of timing.
Barack Obama was president of the United States.
Pause it for 1 second. Okay, so it says message from Jeffrey Epstein.
Jeez.
This is so the text is 1 minute after this in the text is at 7:41 a.m. I don't know what, let's call it 10:41 a.m. to be on the same timeline. A minute after the video, he texts, "Are you chewing?"
Was president of the United States. And while we were once driving through a struggling neighborhood in Chicago,
and she writes back, "Not anymore."
That only black people could live that way. Attorney-client privilege. Yes,
and
I
then,
will turn it over.
Later my that afternoon, Mr. Pointed out, Cohen brought up Rona, keeper of the secrets. He writes to her, "Rona, keeper of the secrets." Now watch. She doesn't know what he's talking about. Go ahead.
In a written submission that contradicted your testimony.
And she says, Rona? Question mark? Question mark?
Did you review? Are you going to review it in our next break to correct the record? Yes or no?
Yes. And he texts, "Quick, I'm up." She writes, "Quick, I'm up next." Is that an acronym? Because he wrote R-O-N-A, all capital. Go ahead.
And you helped out the president's campaign or were involved in the campaign as a representative, as a spokesman, even in your words today.
That's his assistant, he writes. Epstein writes.
Is that accurate? Yes or no?
Yes.
Mr. Weisenberg and other individuals, Ms. Rona. Who are those individuals? Are they with the Trump Organization?
They
are.
Are
there other people that we should be meeting with?
So Alan Weisenberg is the chief financial officer.
Uh-huh. You got to quickly give us as many names as you can so we can get to them.
Yes, ma'am.
Is Ms. Rona, what is Ms. Rona's position?
Rona Graff is the Mr. Trump's executive assistant.
And would she be able to corroborate many of the statements that you've made here?
Yes, she was. Her office is directly next to his.
Good work, he texts 2 minutes after that.
A lot that went on.
Okay, I mean, so all this tells us is that, A, this delegate from the Virgin Islands clearly had a very had enough of a close relationship with Epstein that he was texting. Now, you know, like, That in and of itself is not terribly surprising. They don't have to that relationship does not have to be nefarious in any way. He wants influence in the Virgin Islands. I would imagine if you're going to have that kind of island there, you've bought out everybody. Maybe you haven't bought them out, but maybe it's like, oh, I got you access to whatever, or, you know, I get you tickets to see, you know, whomever it is in New York when you're or D.C., whatever. Who knows what that relationship is, but I'm sure it's like just as corrupt as any other political. But what's interesting is that he's there trying to sink Donald Trump.
Yeah, and there was a question asked earlier, why wouldn't Trump be touting his actions against Epstein if it was true that he was informant? It might have something to do with the fact that Jeffrey Epstein was killed in state custody when Trump was president.
I was about to say. So can you pull up again the when in 2019 this is? It's in the text. Just if you can scroll over
February.
He died in August 2019.
Yeah, so he's going to jail very
soon. He was arrested later this summer.
Yeah, and I still cannot believe that we are not focused more on that Wired reporting from earlier this year. Like, all of this, that Trump just lets so much, because there's so much news, so much goes away. they released supposedly unedited video footage of his jail cell that in it there was metadata showing that they edited out multiple minutes in Adobe, and either an FBI agent left that there as a trail of breadcrumbs for Wired because they are resentful of, like, Cash Patel and Dan Bongino being their new bosses, and they know that it's amateur hour and they want to reveal that something's being covered up, or they're that incompetent and slapdash that they put it together
I find it hard to believe the latter.
It's the former, but yeah. But either way, where is that full footage? They edited out that footage and thought that the public would eat it up, and it was easy enough for Wired to uncover it. I mean, that's shady in and of itself.
All right, let's get to some other news, shall we? Yeah, let's do Vivek, but then I want to get to there's a lot of people who seem to be tired of Chuck Schumer. It's not just us. And then also ICE has decamped to Charlotte, North Carolina, and we're watching sort of this play, we're going to see this in city after city after city. And the folks in Charlotte seem to be rising to the moment and, responding to ICE in the way that you should. But we will get to that in a moment. Here is Vivek Ramaswamy. Do we know how he's doing in the polls? He's running for senator. Isn't
governor?
Oh, is it governor?
Yeah,
he's running for governor, I don't know how he's doing, but he's you know, it's an uphill battle for him because his party almost officially refuses to elect anybody who is not white to any high office.
Amy Acton edges them out in recent polls, apparently.
But we'll see. But here he is, and he is saying something. There's a difference between correlation and causation. For many years, we had a lot of education folks on for years on this program, particularly during the Obama years, as the Obama administration was sort of like picking up the mantle from the Bush administration and corporatizing our education. Largely because Bill Gates Foundation poured $1 billion plus into and dangled a lot of prize money, essentially, and was looking to sell a lot of computers. And their experiment about education went awry, as their own RAND Corporation assessment said. But one of the things I learned from educators, almost all of them would start off every interview with, if you tell me the area code of where they live in, I can look up what the or the zip code, rather, I can look up what the median income is there, and I will tell you what education outcomes are. And so understand that education outcomes are tied to living in poverty. He is trying to make an argument of that is there is a correlation, but he's trying to make a causation. He's got the causation backwards, but here he is.
Well, I think one place to start, so there's not a one-size-fits-all solution, but I believe in practical solutions. One place to start.
We should also say he's at a food drive in Dayton, and somebody asked how you deal with combating childhood hunger in Ohio. Well, the first thing that I would do is I would ask the president to see if we can get a waiver for the cuts to SNAP in our state. That's what I would do if I was Vivek Ramaswamy. That would be the first thing, because 40% of people who get SNAP are children. And they're going to be big cuts to SNAP eligibility going forward. But nevertheless, go ahead.
Solutions. One place to start is actually school. You think about school, chronic absenteeism is now a major problem. It's hitting 25% in certain parts of our state. Childhood hunger and getting a better education and feeding those kids all go together at the same time. Physical education, health, and childhood health. And so I'm not saying fixing the schools solves everything, but it solves a lot. And if we're able to use the infrastructure we already have, including at the public schools across the state, including in Dayton, boy, are we going to make a lot of progress on improving health outcomes, improving childhood hunger, but also childhood educational achievement. If you're thinking in the long run, if everyone...
Pause it for one second. I want you to go back. This is what you say when you have no answer for the question of what would you do to combat childhood hunger in Ohio. The Republican Party has been against free lunches as a bedrock moral principle for since the idea of free lunches in schools. If you want to fight childhood poverty, one of the ways you ensure that every kid gets at least one meal, and maybe two, because you can give free breakfasts as well as free lunches, is to provide free lunch and free breakfast. And free, not just free for kids who are hungry, free for everybody, so you do not stigmatize kids who are getting free lunch at school. But he doesn't know what he's talking about, so he's just bullshitting. I get news for you. Physical ed is not necessarily going to really impact poverty outcomes.
I mean, the fact that he's saying that, why is he so condescending? He sounds like Michelle Obama, right? Well, isn't that what they were so upset about? Now that MAHA is all about like personal choices, shaming people into, you know, making healthy choices instead of addressing it substantively. The Michelle Obama thing was at the very least focused on like the quality of the food in schools, not just like, let's cut programs. And it's interesting because I was on his Wikipedia just to see, like, he apparently identifies as an American, like, conservative nationalist, but wouldn't be a Christian nationalist. We played that clip of the Christian nationalist kid essentially saying, you don't belong here. But Christian nationalists want schools not to have things like free lunches because they want the only place in communities to be churches that provide services to people. If there are public centers of community that provide services, that's a genuine threat to their vision of America. But for a guy like him, he doesn't even have that added element on top. He's just a really, really rich guy capitalist that doesn't want you to have social services. That's it.
All right. So let's go back to him now, just sort of like meandering around the question until he lands on something that is ostensibly insightful, but really just sort of more bullshit.
Improving childhood hunger, but also childhood educational achievement. If you're thinking in the long run, if every one of those kids is able to read by the age of third grade, by 7 or 8 years old, okay? By the end of third grade, if you're reading, you are basically statistically near impossible to end up in poverty. So if we can solve that on the front end, 100% third grade reading guarantee, which, by the way, we used to have in the state, but they got watered down and got rid of. I'm bringing it back. That's the kind of example where not just in the next 20 months, but over the next 20 years, that's how you end childhood hunger and poverty. If you can read by the end of third grade, you're basically not going to end up in poverty. That's what we're going to make sure of when I'm governor. And I hope people can understand that's not about right versus left. That's about right versus wrong. When we're talking about bringing standards back to poverty.
Okay. Here's the point, is that we have looked to our schools to fix social ills for the past 40, 50 years. And the fact of the matter is that it's not the failure of schools that inhibits people's ability to read by third grade. It is the failure of society to provide a basic level of subsistence for its people to give them room for people to learn by third grade. Like I say, if you live in a zip code, if your parents are living at poverty, if your parents need two or three jobs each, there's no opportunity for you as a baby to be exposed enough that you wouldn't have a massive listening vocabulary deficit. The listening vocabulary deficit of children living in poverty is somewhere close to like somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 words that they have not been exposed to in some fashion. Their speaking vocabulary also, you're at a deficit in the tens of thousands of words, possibly, largely, because A, you're left, you're more likely to be in a daycare situation where you're not getting any one-on-one time. B, your parents are probably exhausted because they've been working multiple jobs and they don't read to you at bed. C, you're simply not exposed to stuff. Like, okay, I take my kid to the country. My kid now knows all the words that you see in the country that you wouldn't necessarily see in the city. Like, there's a llama maybe one time, or there's a chicken, or there's a robin or an eagle. And what does that do? Like, on and on and on. And so he's looking at what is an indication of a failure of society to provide for its citizens as causation. Yep. And it's the opposite. School cannot make up for people living in poverty. School cannot make up for potential malnutrition. Kids are hungry. They don't perform as well in school. Everybody knows this. So he is looking for schools outside of being able to provide lunch and meals. They're not going to make up for that deficit. That has to be universal childcare. That has to be universal pre-K. I'm quite convinced that in New York City, we're going to see, once we get past the generation from COVID, as they filter out of the system, because the first year of universal pre-K, that child, I know this, would be in seventh grade right now, and we're going to see the eighth grade results, but they all dealt with COVID. When we clear COVID from the education system, we're going to see a market improvement, I would bet, in reading comprehension by those kids living in lower income getting just pre-K.
But yeah, I mean, it's good to point out that this is a pattern of conservative obfuscation and how they try to push forward austerity politics. They will defund social programs or schools, create failures, and then use those failures as justification to further defund and deprioritize social services or things like schools. And he's just doing a version of the same argument. But I wonder where we're like in this moment of incredible flux and deep income and wealth inequality that's at Gilded Age levels. If people hear this guy saying, as long as you read at the third grade level, you're impossible for you to fall into poverty. And they laugh their asses off at the absurdity of that statement.
Yeah, I don't know where the specific third grade thing comes from, but this is sort of inform an argument Matt Bruning's been dealing with for almost a decade, it seems like now, called the success sequence. Success sequence has found its latest mark. He writes, it says, the success sequence is presented as a series of steps individuals can take that will ensure they have a very low poverty rate. Supposedly, one, finish high school; two, get a full-time job once you finish high school; three, get married before you have children. And, you know, you can read Brunig's takedown of it, but I think anybody should say that
it's reversing causation.
Exactly,
and
very obviously. It's very stupid, well-off people that believe stuff like this.
And the Mill Rind on IM says that answer Vivek gave could have come just as easily from a mainstream Democrat, without a doubt. Certainly a large cohort of Democratic politicians bought into that same stuff. And the Democratic Party has fallen down when it comes to education as much as, well, has fallen down on education. I mean, the Republican Party has specifically wanted to destroy public schools. Democratic politicians have looked for, you know, for lack of a better term, a neoliberal solution, some type of market-based solution, some type of like implication of corporate standards on schools when that is not what education is.
Cory Booker wants to run for president. He was in New Hampshire, I think, over the weekend and sucking up to them saying, I think you should still be the first state, blah, 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 first primary state. I don't know if there's a Democrat who has higher aspirations right now who has been more involved in the privatization of schools and being pro-charter schools in that way.
As a guy who is focusing so much of my effort on ending human suffering on the planet Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. In Newark.
I can't wait for the
Yeah, in Newark, the charter school problem was like, I mean, it was a big part of, it was harmful to the education system there. And Cory Booker was a big proponent of that. Just
it's poisonous for people's political education, too. Yeah. Like this idea that Democrats are out there saying that, well, maybe charter schools could be good and they could help my kid. It's just poisonous for a coalition.
The, you know, the idea of charter schools was first pushed by teachers unions. Because the idea was it makes sense to have like almost like a laboratory where you would try pedagogical techniques that can be scaled up. And then, of course, like so much in the context of our society, it became a way of – and there's – listen, I'm sure there are some good hearted people within the context of charter schools, and I'm sure there are some charter schools that are actually good. But – at the end of the day, more often than not, Massachusetts has some pretty good reforms that make this money accountable. I don't think New York State does. It is draining money from the public school system, and it is not developing anything that is scalable and usable for the public school system. What it's doing is it is just basically exploiting their teachers more. It is also cherry picking. And who is it? Guy from the Manhattan Institute. I interviewed somebody who embedded themselves at Success Academy, and I got him finally to admit in the interview that, okay, they're not cherry picking students. Although they will keep problem students out, and public schools have to educate everybody. And by problem students, I mean ones that create problems for them. That could mean, you know, kids with behavioral issues, but also kids with learning challenges. They just don't want to have to do anything that is not sort of like a conveyor belt, because that's the way that they save money. But this guy from the Manhattan Institute, I can't remember his name, but he wrote a book about it. He was embedded in the Success Academy. What they do is they cherry pick the parents. Because again, if you have the resources, and that may be just a good social infrastructure, it could be money, to be able to show up at a school meeting at 9 a.m., likely that your kids are going to perform well in school because you have the ability to set aside whatever else you're doing to go there. That's the way that they sort of like cherry pick the parents as a surrogate for cherry picking the kids. And public schools have a responsibility to educate everyone.
Yep.
And so these charter schools pull money out of the system and inhibit the ability to educate everyone. Some people it costs a little more to educate than other people. But all right. I'm off my high horse for the day.
Did we cover Marjorie Taylor Greene and Trump for?
I mean, this is.
Because you don't care about this?
I mean, I sort of do.
I just kind of find it a little bit interesting that what Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing right now. Like, in the sense that, not that I believe her for a second as a force for good in the world, but she's doing this thing where she's apologizing for the toxicity of the discourse and showing contrition, at least in the media. And she's being very deliberate in trying to differentiate herself from this current Republican brand, and I would argue probably J.D. Vance specifically, because she's looking at 2028 and the biggest fish. I think Kristi Noem will run in 2028. She wants to be the immigration candidate. But you'll also have J.D. Vance in the race. And both of those two candidates, but J.D. in particular, are the shit-eating Trump people who will just say whatever he says. They have to basically back the president because of the nature of this administration, that he only tolerates sycophancy. And Trump puts them in an uncomfortable situation on a basically daily basis with the amount of inconsistencies and lies that he's told. So she's on the outside looking like the person that is more independent than them. That's my theory. Wait, about what she's
doing. What do you think she's trying to do here? I mean, yes, I do not think that this is a function of, like, she has had some sincere whatever it is, and I have no idea how.
Although
she
got divorced, and it seems like this Newsmax guy is maybe a better husband. He was like tweeting out a defense of her, so in defiance of the president, shocking.
Well, regardless of what her intent is, what's in her heart, I don't really care.
Yeah.
I doubt that she would be voting for stuff that I would appreciate. We will never know because it's a Republican administration. They don't put up any legislation that is worth voting for. Or
exactly.
I don't even think they vote on, like, outside of a post office. But she is definitely trying to separate. She definitely has separated herself from Donald Trump.
That's what I'm interested in.
What do you
in.
Think her political agenda is? Like, does she need this to win her seat in Congress? I don't
know.
Think
so. She has broader aspirations, which I think has to be president at this point, right? Or 2028, because she got boxed out and Trump in this post admits that exactly what AOC was gossiping about. Yeah. And I say that with, like, please more AOC.
Now she's going out. Marjorie Taylor Greene has gone out and been, you know, released the Epstein files. And she's, you know, she's been picking fights with Trump.
Yep.
And Donald Trump has had it. I am withdrawing my support and endorsement. I'll capitalize that E. Because endorsement's bigger than support of Congresswoman, all in quotes, please.
And, like, he has to put it all in quotes. Just get to the point.
I know.
He
needs
to put a message on every word.
Okay.
Also, is he trying to say there's
Matt?
No... Yeah.
In quotes.
Or, like,
can
no,
you put Marjorie in italics?
He's putting is he putting Congresswoman in italics because it should be Congressman?
I don't know.
No, I think he's just trying to say, like, she's not
She's a fake. She's like,
she's a fake.
She doesn't deserve the title.
Okay.
Marjorie Taylor Greene of the great state of Georgia. I still like Georgia. I don't take it out on them.
It's not in quotes.
This is all parenthetical. This is in my head. Over the past few weeks, despite my creating record achievements, that's a capital A and R, for our country, including a total and complete victory on the shutdown. I call it TCV. Capitalize the T and the C and the V. Victory on the shutdown. Close borders, or I call CB. Low taxes, LT. No relation. No men in women's sports or transgender for everyone. I ended that.
That's number
Ending
three.
DEI. Stopping Biden's record-setting inflation.
Well...
biggest regulation cuts in history, stopping 8 wars, all in caps.
As he bombs both off the coast of Venezuela.
Prepares for one.
Yeah, and they bring up troops.
Rebuilding our military, no beards. Being respected by every country in the world, as opposed to the laughingstock that we were just 12 months ago. Things have turned around quick. Having trillions of dollars, record-setting, invested in the U.S., incidentally, parenthetically speaking, should tell you, we have had investments from countries, sometimes multiples of their GDP, money that they will never, ever have. They have to go into hawk. It's credit card bills. Okay, getting back to the actual truth of bomb. And having created the hottest country anywhere in the world from being a dead country just 12 months ago and so much more.
We're 200 years old, but you would think we were 15.
Oh, my God.
So
exactly.
We were a laughingstock, but also dead 12 months ago. Like,
we were dead
12 months ago.
Yes, because we weren't hot. All I see
12 months ago.
Wacky Marjorie do is... didn't he use wacky for somebody else, or is this it?
I feel like he's used wacky.
Wacky Marjorie do is complain, complain, complain. She's like your first and second and third ex-wives.
Wacky Omarosa, wacky Jackie for Jackie Rosen. Wacky Marjorie is the new one. Gotta love the Wikipedia entry, list of nicknames used by Donald Trump.
Wacky Omarosa.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot about it.
He did wacky Elizabeth Warren, too.
Oh, right. That was wacky and crazy and our reserve for
the wacky
women.
Do-nothing Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel. I agree with that one.
It seemed to all begin when I sent her a poll stating that she should not run for senator or governor. She was at 12% and didn't have a chance. This is what we've been saying.
Yep.
He's spurned.
But he contradicts himself a little bit. She didn't have a chance Unless, of course, she had my endorsement, which she wasn't about to get.
Right.
I'm taking back the endorsement that I was never going to give her.
Yeah, yeah.
She has told many people that she's upset I don't return her phone calls anymore. But with 219 congressmen, women, 53 U.S. senators, 24 cabinet members, almost 200 countries, and otherwise...
And one Laura Loomer.
And Laura Loomer, who I'm on the phone with 24/7, and otherwise normal life to lead, I can't take a ranting lunatic's call every day. I want you to note what is missing from all the things that he's like, I've got to reach for when I talk about. 219 congressmen, 53 senators, 24 cabinet members, almost 200 countries, and an otherwise normal life to lead. I can't take a ranting lunatic. Notice he doesn't mention a wife, children, grandchildren. Like, the American people. Yeah. Okay, whatever. He doesn't even mention his grandkids or his kids. He didn't even, like, think about it to even lie about.
That's the normal life part. That's all covered in
that. Yeah, normal life.
Normal things.
I can't take a ranting lunatic's call every day. I understand that wonderful conservative people are thinking about primarying Marjorie in her district of Georgia. District of Georgia. Yeah.
Oh.
I can't be bothered to look up. Listen, I'm on a roll. What am I going to do? Look up whatever
the
congressional seat is, whatever. Come on. That they, too, are fed up with her and her antics, and if the right person runs, they will have my complete and unyielding support. She's gone far left, even doing The View. IQ Republican-hating anchors. Thank you again for your attention to this matter. Great again.
We don't need to pull up the tweet. You can just take my word for it. But, Wacky Omarosa. But
let me just read this tweet first. Wacky Omarosa has a fully signed non-disclosure agreement, and that's what the President of the United States tweeted in 2018.
The top response to Sam's sign tweeting out that screenshot of Trump's Truth Social is from, you guessed it, Laura Loomer. You love to see it, she responds, because she hates Marjorie because, Laura Loomer is a crazy Zionist, too.
The other woman.
Meanwhile, she's getting a lot of hate stuff from MAGA people.
Loomer? Yes.
Or Marjorie Taylor Greene is claiming that she is. She may be. I don't know.
But good luck with this, Trump. I actually, if in a battle between the two of them, I'm not sure who wins in the MAGA hearts. Like, Trump is weaker right now than with this Epstein thing, and I still maintain this in 2024. Do you know who got the highest percentage of their money from small dollar donations?
Oh, Marjorie Taylor Greene was the top fundraiser. I think like number two
is AOC, number three is Bernie Sanders.
But I'm saying in the Republican Party, that I think she was one of the top fundraisers in the Republican side.
Yeah, and that's not just like, billionaire money being dumped into your race, J.D. Vance. This is like genuine enthusiasm from their base about her. So I think she's leveraging that, and she knows that she can leverage that, and she knows that Trump is weak about this Epstein thing right now.
I think she also, she must be thinking, look, there's going to be a post-Trump world. And if I keep my attacks on Trump as Trump, then I can build some credibility I can get into mainstream politics and have either a governor or a Senate race, maybe in 5 or 6 years when there's a different president.
It's moderate Marjorie.
Can you just pull up the tweet I sent of his attempts at nicknames for her really briefly? Because this is fun, too, to see him struggling. You might find this funny. But he's been trying out new nicknames for her in this crash out about upset. So he can't decide between Marjorie Trader Green.
That's a better one.
Marjorie Taylor Brown. And then he has to explain it. Brian, good comedian has, when you have to explain the joke, it's a good
working.
Thing.
It's gold.
Green grass turns brown when it begins to rot. Also, Does grass rot?
Your grass doesn't rot. I mean, it turns brown.
It dies.
Whatever. He knows more about grass than anybody alive. You don't remember that?
What?
He said he knows more about grass than anybody on earth.
Yes, he said that.
So you better be careful with what you're about to say.
I was going to say it's just it turns brown when it's not watered.
It dries. It dies. It doesn't rot like fruit.
See, his problem is you should just say it's Marjorie Taylor Brown because she's poopy. That'd be way more funny than
yeah, that's what I thought when I first Brown. Saw it.
Or just call her Marjorie Taylor shit. And like...
Marjorie Taylor Brown, because that's her real hair color.
Yeah, exactly.
Ooh.
Green grass.
Sassy.
Brian, Marjorie... off camera, did a cougar motion.
Green grass turns brown. Why are you talking about grass, you weirdo?
So of those two ones, Marjorie Trader Green is probably better, but both are pretty bad for his standards.
Marjorie Taylor Envy, because green is envy. Green she's envy. Jealous.
Yeah.
Marjorie Taylor Sanctimonious. Rhonda Sanctimonious was the best.
That was a great one.
Was pretty amazing.
They had him on the right drug cocktail at that point.
Low Energy Jev is my favorite.
I love Low Energy, but that's like, God, that's vintage at this point.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
10 one.
Years old.
Peak.
That peak. Was his peak, right. When he was destroying other Republicans, that's what we liked him most. Yeah. Yeah.
But he would shrink down to do Bloomberg as a short guy.
Oh.
We'll do more of an update on these ICE videos tomorrow because they've moved into North Carolina.
Barack Obama.
But we should talk about this one. There was rumors that broke over the weekend, and I don't know if they've been substantiated, but there are rumors coming out of Chuck Schumer's office that he is not going to seek re-election. Now, of course, he's there until 2028.
How about you resign?
And there was report that his longtime a communications person left recently, which is a weird thing to do. Like, unless you're convinced that this is a short-term tenure, and if I can get on with a younger senator who's going to be there for years, I'm going to have my job in the Senate. And so we'll see where staff starts to go. Some are going to have to hang in there till the bitter end. But the real question is, and I misstated the other day, the PCCC, Indivisible, Move On, they basically came out and did not ask Schumer to resign from the Senate. They said step down as leader.
Yep.
And that is the call that we're going to see. Now, sometimes, you put out a rumor that you're going to retire at the end of your term as a way of letting a little air out of the tire for calls for you to step down. Because, now we're just talking about timing. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be Senate leader in 2028. So, all it's going to take is a little bit of patience. You're going to get your goal. That's why that type of leak goes out. That doesn't mean that he's not going to retire. I think he is. But the fact of the matter is, we got to deal with Donald Trump for another 3 years.
I would love if he would resign in time for the 2026 cycle so a certain Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez could get her feet wet in the Senate before 2028 rolls around.
I would be completely in favor
of
something like that.
Everybody in this room would love that.
I'm just throwing that out there into the universe as a hopeful possibility.
I mean, but wouldn't Hochul do the appointment? And my guess is we would not like who she appoints.
Well, we'll see. I mean...
But I don't know how that works. There could be a short-term...
It's a short-term appointment.
But I think a short-term meaning till the rest of the term. I remember that's what happened when Clinton became Secretary of Defense. Secretary of State. But nevertheless,
anyway,
we should look into that.
That's my half-baked theory.
Here is, at the very least, one step at a time, and that
you
is...
You are right, it's governor.
Yeah, and I don't think Hochul is going to put AOC in there, to be honest with you.
All
so
right.
Careful what you wish for. But he could step down as Senate, now minority leader. There are people out there who are pushing Chris Van Hollen. And I would imagine... you do not get an organized group, and I can't remember exactly who it was.
While you're looking for that, let me just say, I've been on this Chris Van Hollen thing for months.
You have.
And he is exactly the kind of leader that they should be looking towards. The guy that he was the first senator, really, to change the conversation around immigration, to go down and put the pressure on the administration when it was not popular within the Democratic Party in Washington to do so, to put pressure on them to release Kamar Brego Garcia. He has shown through action and even throughout Biden's presidency with his opposition to the genocide that he would be an improvement in ways that I can't even adequately describe right now.
But the important thing to note is that if you have any groups that are pushing Van Hollen, they're not doing it without his permission.
Yep.
And this is here it is here. National progressive groups are privately circulating talking points on why they think Chris Van Hollen should be the next Senate minority leader, I'm told. This is reported by an Axios reporter. Now, here's the thing. You know when talking points are not private? When a reporter has been told about them.
Good job. Good job leaking, folks. Get that. Get Van Hollen's name out there early.
The interesting thing is there is no name on this.
Oh.
This document. There, like, it's unclear, like, what.
Oh, the source document?
Yes.
So they're getting that information elsewhere. We have Chris Murphy on the screen, but Murphy wants to run for president.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Murphy's going to be running for president. But here he is. And again, the flip side of letting the air out of the tire if you're going to retire in 2028 in terms of the calls for you to step down as leader, the flip side of that is that, like, well, now I know that he's not going to be here in 3 or 4 years. So how much do I really need him?
Chuck Schumer's taken a lot of heat for this. Do you still have confidence in him as the Democratic leader? And do you think he will still be the Democratic leader after the midterms?
Well, we can't continue to operate like this in the Democratic Senate. This is not the first time that a small group of Democrats have crossed over to support Republican measures that give Donald Trump more power. So I've been candid with him and with my colleagues that the Democrats are going to lose this democracy if we continue to allow Republicans to cleave off 10 or 12 or 15 of us. So we've got some hard conversations as a caucus moving forward. We can't continue to be split like this, or we won't save our democracy. And
so
certainly when we return to Washington next week, Senator Schumer is going to have to explain to us how we're going to run the caucus differently, how we're going to be more united.
I've got an answer. It's social media. We're all going to do TikToks.
No, you got to look at me.
TikTokies.
Chuck, you got to look more creepily over in my direction as you say that.
We're all going to do TikTokies.
What do you mean, though? What kind of TikTok?
Oh, all the TikTokies that we're going to do the social media. What do you mean? What am I going
to
do?
To what end?
We're going to win.
Win what?
Everything. We're going to win the social media.
But this most importantly, the left will become pro-Israel again. Right?
Oh, well, of course. We're doing it's the new TikTok-y.
Did you tell me that his...
Ask me any question. AQ.
Your communications staffer resigned?
Ask me. AMQ.
Okay.
That's what they say.
Your communications staffer resigned? Is that what you said earlier?
Yes, but that's just a coincidence.
Hard to imagine why.
Why? AMQ. Ask me question. Go ahead.
That's not how it goes.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
What's your response to the senators who broke off from the...
Broke off?
From the other Democrats. They voted against keeping the shutdown going.
Yeah. Did you hear about that?
What?
Anything?
Yeah.
No, we're going to win. Everybody's staying up late. Everybody's up late.
I missed this, obviously, last week. Didn't get to hear enough of your coverage of Chuck here. What? I don't understand how he's trying to pull this off. Okay. I'm going to look elsewhere.
I'll tell you.
How are you trying to pull this off?
Social media. Someone
say, Chuck. Yes? Someone say that either you were... if you aren't
Spit
across...
Yeah, go ahead. What do you got?
All right.
AMQ.
If you aren't able to keep your caucus together,
yeah.
Eight Democrats in the Senate, eight? And they go okay. rogue and you
no.
have...
No, I voted no!
Yeah, and you have no idea...
I voted no!
...how they're voting. That's also a failure of leadership, even if you vote no. So, like, which one is it? Are you a good leader in the Senate and you're able to keep your caucus together?
Day one, they all wanted to vote for the thing that I didn't want them to vote for. And I said, hey, hold on.
But they did it. So does that mean that you're an effective leader?
Yes.
If you can't keep them together?
I am. Of course.
And how would you measure your effectiveness?
Well, look it. I'm here. I'm the leader, so
and you don't
course,
have dementia yet, as of
what? No,
as of what we know.
Can you name one accomplishment that you're proud of since this Trump's 2.0?
Yes, started? I haven't rested.
Well, you disappear for months at a time, though. It seems like
I'm actually. That's the thing. I'm being so strenuous that I don't want people to see it. I'm trying to protect people from seeing how hard I'm working at it.
Don't let them see you sweat.
Don't want to rub it in people's faces.
Do you and Dick Durbin still share a house?
No. Maybe. Okay. AMQ.
Durbin, one of the eight who voted. Yeah.
AMQ. I'm an open book.
But Chuck, your best friend in the world voted to reopen the government.
I know. I was very mad because I said, don't do it. I said, don't. Do it. Yeah.
Must have been awkward when you guys. It was so awkward. The kitchen and
yeah.
Stuff.
Pass the salt.
I
please.
Mean, they slept butt to butt that night, not front facing, looking at each other.
Right.
It was a really tense night in the twin bed.
I'm going to stay leader.
Okay.
I'll get to that. Slurp. Is Chuck Schumer just Hugo? Look, at this point in my career, I'm not going to develop another voice. I'm just doing one voice. It's either my voice or just slightly higher register. That's it.
You got Alex Jones, too.
I get Alex Jones, too. I can do that.
So high voice, low voice.
High voice, low voice. All right. I'm going to read a couple IMs, then we'll get out of here.
Sounds good.
Emma's bed metaphor for Schumer and Durbin is a horrific image I need to scrub from my brain, says Snarkorski.
Don't Google it. It's,
I don't think that's a metaphor.
It's barely a metaphor. I'm barely exaggerating about the closeness of their living quarters.
Night, Chuck. Night, Dick.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
It's the odd couple, except for they're both the same.
Yeah.
It's the even couple.
That is bad writing. The buddy cop comedy where they're both
there's no tension.
They both play by the rules.
I should leave. That's right. Hugo came back last week and you didn't tell us. How can we trust you for the big news if you left that off? What was the episode? I there's a couple. I don't think it's the I got a big episode. We recorded it so long ago. I don't know when it's coming out, but it's literally me and Benjamin in an elevator. Don't tell anybody. I said that. I probably shouldn't leak it. Amy from the UK. Hi, Sam, Matt, and Brian. Whoa. People forgot.
How rude.
People forgot. Oh, they probably IM'd some other show to get. Sam, Matt, and Brian, I can't order from the current merch store, unfortunately, as I'm in the UK. Could MR look into a tea mill store? They're an eco-friendly merch hosting company, and their website's here. I'll look into it. But, you know, our stuff is
union made.
Union and U.S.-based. So we gotta, that's the constraints we're under. Can I get Noel from San Francisco? Can I get a what kind of bowl is this? Glenn Beck ate my day, dad. The special secret social media. Nick At, who knew Emma was a magician? She was everywhere last week, seeming all at once. Jab from Virginia, are you on some right now, Father? I don't know what that means. Krusty Gnome, Jordan Peterson, Schumer, and Hugo are all the same person.
What kind of bull is this?
Nice. Mark Eggerson, Mary Jane Monday. Oh, that was us laughing at the beginning there. We just had the giggles at the beginning of the week.
We?
Well,
I caught
Tom,
him.
Tom, yeah, Brian got him. Tom's cotton beard, display leave Brittany alone meme, but insert Emma in place of Brittany. All right, and the final I am of the day. Rafi, they're celebrating the MRI machines on a perfectly healthy, they're calibrating the MRI machines on a perfectly healthy individual. All right, folks, see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie bar. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know.